This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Mr. Mike Ward on the 19th of April, 2003. At approximately 12:25, we are in Charlottesville, Virginia, the Sleep In Conference Room. Sir, first, thanks for consenting to this interview. Why don't we go ahead and begin with a discussion of your early life. Just tell me when and where you were born, where you grew up.
I was born January 28th, 45 in Kansas City, Missouri. Stayed in Kansas City until I was about 14 years old. My father died when I was 10. And at 14, my mother went to work as a district sales manager for Avon, and we moved to Poplar Bluff, Missouri.
Wow.
Which was in the Boot Heel of Missouri. And went to high school in Poplar Bluff. And my mother told me I was living in a peach orchard and didn't know it, and she was probably right. It was a very nice, had a good childhood. And went to high school in Poplar Bluff and played football, and met my first wife, childhood sweetheart, Jennifer. And she was 13 and I was 15 when we met. And we actually, I was 21 and she was 18-ish when we got married. After high school, I went to Georgia Tech in Atlanta. Studied chemical engineering there. Actually, I received three deferments, draft deferments, during the Vietnam era. And I graduated from Georgia Tech in December, in 3.5 years. Actually, I went to school year round, 12 months out of the year, and got out in 3.5 years.
Were they quarters or semesters?
Quarters. Or semesters, actually. And so, I started in the summer right after high school. Just went straight through. And worked on a cooperative education program where I worked part of the time. And, and actually, that's where I ended up going to Georgia Tech, because I could work in my field and go to school.
Who did you work for?
Tsuba Geigy, a Japanese chemical company. And worked in their R&D department.
What, any specific area of chemical engineering?
No.
In R&D?
No, just at that time you were just kind of a grunt doing little odds and ends. And,
I see.
And nothing real specific, just learning the basic tools of the trade and pilot plant development and that kind of thing. So.
Did they focus on any specific form of engineering or manufacturing?
Well, Tsuba Geigy is a huge chemical company and worked quite a bit in the pharmaceutical side. But nothing specific. It was a way to gain some general experience and to make, at that time, a nice little sum of money to help me through school and, and got credit for it and was one of the few schools that did that. And that's for sure why I went to Georgia Tech. And
go ahead.
And so got out in late December. And
what year?
That would have been 66. And 7 days later, reported for draft.
Oh, my goodness.
At that point in time, I think most people have absolutely had no comprehension of how the draft worked. And it was on a quota basis. And your draft board was given a number. And they had to go deep in the pools. They had to go to get that number. And and this was the Poplar Bluff, Missouri pool I was drafted out of, because that's where I registered. And I remember on the bus going after the induction, I was inducted in St. Louis, Missouri. And I remember there was a guy on the bus that was married with a child. I remember there were three people there that were actually still in college. So a deferment only puts you in a chronological order, not an absolute must. So that made me feel a little bit better. And went and to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri for basic training.
Let me take you back little bit, some follow-up questions regarding your... Some of your, if you don't feel comfortable talking about this, just let me know. Your father dying when you were so young, how did that impact you most? Besides the obvious, I mean, losing your dad.
My mother was very strong. Mm-hmm. She was not prepared to do what she had to do, but she did what she had to do. Mm-hmm. And like you say, other than the obvious, I don't think it was more traumatic for me than it was anybody else, and I don't think it changed a whole lot of things. I had two older brothers, and they made some mistakes and gave my mother some problems that she didn't need, and probably made me be a better person because I saw I didn't want to give her that grief that they gave her.
Yeah.
Not that it was all that bad,
but
my brother selling my dad's golf clubs.
Oh, goodness.
You know, so little things like that and just realize there's better ways to do things.
Yeah.
So I think it helped give me a little maybe integrity and and a work ethic.
Mm-hmm.
And but I had we grew up in an incredibly, incredibly loving family where there was never a harsh word between my parents that we were aware of if it happened. And my mother to this day swears that there wasn't ever a harsh word.
Wow.
Very stern discipline.
Mm-hmm.
My father died of lung cancer. He smoked one carton of cigarettes a day. Carton of Lucky Strikes or Camels. He would light up one time in the morning, light one cigarette in the morning, and then light one cigarette after another. And I remember, you know, him smoking two or three packs of cigarettes in the evening before I would go to bed. So he died of lung cancer, you know. And I remember an instance when after he'd had one lung removed and was home, maybe weighed 110 pounds or something, and it was in the morning time, and my mother had fixed something for breakfast, and I didn't like it, whether it was oatmeal, or whether it was cereal, or vice versa, didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked back to my mother, and he drug himself out of bed and took me by the scruff of my neck and took me downstairs and gave me a sharp whipping with a belt and reminded me I should never talk to my mother like that. And crawled back upstairs and crawled to get back in bed.
My goodness.
So we came from a pretty strong, disciplined family.
Mm-hmm.
Got our butt beat when we needed to get our butt beat and was spoiled rotten by my father.
Mm-hmm.
My father was an orphan. Mm-hmm. And my dad was the first person, we were the first person on the street to have a television. We were the first. We had an ultrasonic door opener on our garage in the early 50s, where it was a whistle actually that made it work.
Mm-hmm.
We had the first Polaroid camera.
Mm.
So my dad was a big gadget freak.
What did he do for work?
My father was a classical entrepreneur. Where he made his most money is he made turf boards, calculating boards. I'm sure you've seen the movie The Sting, where the bookies are writing up on the chalkboards results of the races. He made those boards and sold them to the bookies. And the interesting part was when they made these boards, they basically would buy a blackboard. They had a machine that made the oak frame that went around it, and they had stencils where they would stencil. They had football, baseball, basketball boards. And after they stenciled the lines on the board, the last thing they would do was spray a coat of shellac over the board.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about a blackboard with shellac on, it's slick. Mm-hmm. You can't write on slick anything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, where he really made his money on was not selling the blackboards, but he sold Belgium chalk, which was a big square piece of chalk about an inch and a half square that was creamy in nature, very soft, and would write on these blackboards. And he sold these boxes of chalk that were about 5 by 5 by 5 for $5 a box. Now, in the late 40s and early 50s, $5 was a lot of money, especially in concert where he bought these Belgian chalk for 10 cents a box. And to give you an idea of the volume of chalk he sold, I remember as a pup in Kansas City going down to the on a Sunday to sign for a barge load of chalk.
A barge?
Barge. Sold a lot of chalk. Sold chalk to all the bookies in all the United States, all over Las Vegas. So, and later in all, my dad, after the key falls rack was passed, which made it illegal to transmit horse results over the wire, he got into the advertising business and was a very creative man. He developed a little... the light bulb man with the lightning bolt body, ready kilowatt. That was originally his promotion for the Kansas City Power and Light. So he was a very creative person.
Yeah.
And we had a very comfortable life and lived very nicely.
Wow. That is very nice. Now,
and so how does that affect you can't?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But my mother then was an incredibly successful district sales manager for Avon. She had 180 ladies working for her and ended up being, I think, in the, I don't know, top quarter of 1% of all Avon managers in the country. It was very successful.
Wow. Well, how did that impact you in terms of, it's a little bit early to talk about this in terms of your post-military career, but you yourself got into business.
Yes.
After your military experience.
And I'm... I think most people would define me to know me, say that I'm the classical entrepreneur, risk taker. And I continue to constantly take risk and have been very lucky.
And you know, obviously got bit by that bug.
No, I don't think I got bit by the bug. I think it was... I
were brought up in that atmosphere.
I don't think so.
No?
I think it's my mom said that my dad would bet on two cockroaches going up the side of a wall. In other words, he was a betting person. And I'm a betting person.
Okay.
I'll bet. I'll gamble. Now, the older you get, the more conservative your gambling becomes. And that's how I'm in business. The older I am, the more conservative my bet's in business. But I'm still into literally, if you're a very successful entrepreneur, you have to be able to, you have to be able to gamble everything all the time. Because if you can't, you won't survive and grow. But with that said, I think it's more of a... I think it's something you're born with in a set of traits. Some of those traits are developed or not. But I think all of my brothers are entrepreneurs. All of my brothers basically have never worked for any long periods of time for other people. So I think it's... there are some... some learned traits, but I think most of them just—it's in your gene pool. That's my key.
Yeah, very interesting. And it did run into your, not just yourself, but your siblings. Yeah. Okay. Well, as you were growing up in Poplar Bluff, how aware were you of events going on outside of your immediate community? In particular, of course, the major global events. As you were getting as you were in high school, you know, the Cold War's full swing, and got all kinds of you know, difficult things going on, whether it be the launching of Sputnik, before that, of course, the Hungarian uprising, you know, Khrushchev and his speeches, and the antagonism between him and Kennedy, all kinds of really interesting things. Were you aware of those types of events going up?
Absolutely not. Okay. As I said, as I mentioned earlier, my mother said I was in a peach orchard and didn't know it. My years in high school were strictly with being in high school, with, you know, playing football and going out on Friday night and worried about getting a full tank of gas that week and needing a set of brakes for my car and absolutely was in a world of a very sheltered world of growing up and getting an average education in a very average high school environment.
What subjects did you gravitate toward in school?
Math and sciences.
Okay.
I'm to this day a terrible speller. I was dyslexic, and I'm still dyslexic today. I was terribly dyslexic at a young age and probably hardly could read until I was maybe 8 or 9 years old.
Wow.
And then a switch just came on and caught right up. Because I came from a comfortable economic family, mm-hmm. I had a reading teacher every summer. I would a couple hours every day.
Mm.
And I just struggled until probably I was 10 years old. I just couldn't. I was at least a couple of grades behind in reading. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't read. And of course, my spelling skills were terrible. I'm still a poor speller. I'm still a terrible speller. But about at 10 or 11, about when my dad died, a switch just came on, mm-hmm. and within a few months, I caught back up to my grade level and was just fine and never had any trouble since then.
Okay.
I have two children, mm-hmm. a son and a daughter, and my son was very dyslexic also.
Okay.
So it definitely runs in our family.
Yeah.
And to this day, I have terrible problems with it.
Mm-hmm.
No, livable.
I was just going to say,
but
not too terrible. You're doing all right. So, now, how old were you when you got your first job? And what did you do?
I mean, what do you call a job?
Well, when was the first time you went out and actually tried to make money doing something? That as far as you can recall,
maybe 8 or 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
They were doing construction in our neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
and I think all my brothers and I got in some trouble with the construction people because mm-hmm. we lived in a nice area outside of Kansas City, and they were starting to build it up, and they were taking our woods over, our playgrounds
mm-hmm.
that we used to roam and we probably got in some mischief in the construction. And this is probably back to what you were saying about influence of my father. He said, what you boys really need to do is you need to capitalize on this. Well, what do you mean? You should go help the workmen and maybe we can do something. Well, he went out and got, as you've seen, an old metal Coca-Cola box
mm-hmm.
and would bring ice and Cokes home. We put them on a wagon and pull them down the street and sell cold Cokes to the workmen.
Yeah,
and was something to keep us occupied, got us to think that they weren't the bad guys, and
mm-hmm.
taught us how to make some money. So
yeah.
Maybe in some, that's a good example. My father was starting to teach us an entrepreneurial way of doing things,
mm-hmm.
an entrepreneurial way of making something positive out of a negative.
Right.
So that was probably the very first thing I thought of, or I can relate.
Mm-hmm.
I remember in high school, I had a business selling advertising specialties.
Okay.
Pens and pencils and stuff.
Hmm.
And I could kind of do it on my own time, and those kind of things tend to pay very high commissions. And,
mm-hmm.
and I, at that time, would make, you know, $15 or $50 selling something. And,
hmm.
and that was a great deal for me, and so I did that,
mm-hmm.
and I remember I started college in the 1st of August at Georgia Tech,
mm-hmm.
and in July, I set up a fireworks stand after my senior year in high school, and I sold fireworks,
mm-hmm.
and made several hundred dollars. That was a lot of money then,
mm-hmm.
over a 10-day period. And that was kind of my seed money to go down to Georgia Tech.
Okay.
And then at Georgia Tech, I started doing things that after my freshman, after my freshman year at Tech, I was visiting a friend in semester break. I was going to medical school in Guadalajara
mm-hmm.
and saw some Tiffany-style lamps. Now, this was like in 61. It was a very new type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And these were just the real handmade, gorgeous glass light fixtures. And I brought, and I'd driven down to Guadalajara, and I came back with a half a dozen of these things, and I wired them up, and I sold them and made several hundred dollars off of them. And I thought, this is a pretty good deal.
Mm-hmm.
And so the next semester break, I borrowed a pickup truck, went down there, got a few hundred bucks together and brought a pickup truck load back and started a business selling Tiffany lamps. And by my senior year in college, I had a brand new Corvette that was paid for. And I think my tax return my senior year of college was like I made $25,000
or $28,000.
Holy cow. So...
How frequently would you go down to Guadalajara to get more lamps?
Well, by that time, I had other people doing it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'd rent out.
Yeah, I'd rent a little building and mm-hmm. storefront in, mm-hmm. in Atlanta, just actually 3 or 4 blocks off campus, mm-hmm. and we would wire them up there. And actually, we were selling mostly directly to light fixture studios in Atlanta, mm-hmm. selling a few of them out the front for retail, mm-hmm. and doing very well.
That is amazing.
And went from that into an E1 into the Army.
What a horrible experience that was.
Yeah.
Well,
so that was a big shock.
Yes, absolutely.
I was just going.
When you enrolled in Georgia Tech, did you already know you wanted to be a chemical engineering major, or was that something you fell into? Or?
Well, I think it was guided that way because mm-hmm. of test scores and that type thing.
Okay.
Just I was strong in math, and mm-hmm. math and sciences, and mm-hmm. weak elsewhere.
Okay.
Which probably had something to do with my dyslexia also. Mm-hmm. Didn't affect those things quite as much.
Right.
To this day, don't have much problem with numbers, but I have a great, more of a problem with letters mm-hmm. than mixing them up. But I mix numbers up too.
Okay. Given your obvious business bent, I'm surprised that you didn't get into a business program. But did you think about it?
Well, Georgia Tech wasn't a business school.
Right. But certainly they offered business classes.
Not much.
No?
No.
Oh, okay.
No.
All right. Well, was there something in particular about chemical engineering, something that you thought about doing after you graduated with that degree that you wanted to do? Was there a specific area of chemical engineering you wanted to get into?
Well, I can't recall right now.
Okay.
It probably had more to do with... Probably more to do with scheduling the classes and how they affected my business doings.
Okay. All right.
And Tsubagaigi.
Okay, yeah.
Which, you know, I stayed with Tsubagaigi the whole time and learned a lot off of him.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. You mentioned that you played football in high school. Did you continue that in track as well? No.
I was a very average football player.
Okay. Well, and what else did you do growing up in Poplar Bluff as far as, as you got older, entertainment types of things, whether it be movies or whatever? Hunting, or I don't know what Poplar Bluff has to offer a young person growing up.
Poplar Bluff has very little to offer a young person growing up, but just a very good friend network.
Mm-hmm.
To this day, some of my absolute best friends are my high school friends from Poplar Bluff that we still are very close to. My first girlfriend before my first wife is still a very good friend of mine, and we talk at least monthly on the phone still. And the man she married was still one of my best friends that I talked to a couple of times a year that we're still very close to.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we didn't do a whole lot. There wasn't a lot to do in Papa's Bluff.
Mm-hmm.
Go to the show on the weekend.
Yeah.
Go to the A&W root beer stand,
mm-hmm.
Which one of the teachers in the high school owned the root beer stand. Was open about 6 or 8 months out of the year. Nickel mm-hmm. root beers.
Okay.
And, you know, there's two sides of town cruising between the east and the mm-hmm. west side of the town.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lake, Wapapello, north of Poplar Bluff, which Lake Wapapello later became famous on one of the TV programs, Designing Women.
Oh.
The producer of Designing Women was a friend of ours, Linda Bloodworth,
mm-hmm.
that we grew up with in Poplar Bluff.
Oh.
And in her show, she drew a lot of Poplar Bluff in there. Going to Lake Wapapello, a lot of the friends' names, things that we grew up with, she used in that show.
Yeah.
And just a typical Midwestern mm-hmm. easygoing, low pressure. That was the center of the world, mm-hmm. the peach orchard.
Yeah. Well, when you were in school from 62 to 66, or 63 to 66, of course, in the middle of that, your first year, Kennedy was assassinated. How did that mm-hmm. affect you and in your the people that live near you there at Texas, Georgia Tech?
You've asked a couple times about how world events affected me back then. Really didn't.
You don't.
I remember that.
You remember?
I remember, of course, the footstep were exactly where I was at school, going up the administrative building. Mm-hmm. And somebody saying that, of course, I remember the exact second that it happened.
Yeah.
But I was just getting started in school. It was a big transition for me. It was more difficult than I thought it was going to be. Mm-hmm. It's a tough school. Mm-hmm. And I struggled that first year very hard to do what I had to do to stay in. Mm-hmm. So I was very eaten up with, again, just the mundane things. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it affected my thought process much or what I had to do each day to survive and get along. Yeah.
How about the Vietnam War as it was unfolding from 64, the Gulf of Tonkin instance in August, through the time you graduated? Did you pay very much attention to the news and stuff coming back from Vietnam?
Well, because I was on a college campus, mm-hmm. because I was going through deferments, mm-hmm. I was well aware of what was going on. But especially towards the last, I was concerned timing-wise about, was I going to be able to get through school? Because mm-hmm. I was well aware, out of the draft board we were out of, that they were in big trouble. Mm-hmm. They were in serious trouble for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't for sure whether I was going to get through school. Mm-hmm. And I was, because of my little business I had going and mm-hmm. everything else, I was a little bit distraught at that, those last 6 months, the fall of that year, whether everything was going to get flipped upside down or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you did graduate in 66, how concerned were you? I mean, you received a draft notice that you...
I got an induction notice to report before I was out.
And they knew you were graduating, and your number was up.
Because I already had two deferments that got changed.
Right.
I went from whatever the school deferment was to school deferment married. Mm-hmm. Got married my last year there.
Okay.
So I had a school deferment and married. They knew exactly where, they knew where I was at when I was getting out.
Okay.
That's ground hamburger. That's it. Gone. Kiss your ass goodbye.
Did you give any thought to circumventing the draft system and enlisting or going into one of the services voluntarily on your own terms?
Absolutely not.
No.
My thought process at that time was just get it over with.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, Georgia Tech was land-grant school? Or no?
Absolutely. Yeah, I was ROTC.
Yeah, so you went through ROTC.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I went through the compulsory ROTC only.
Okay, you only went for 2 years.
Right.
Okay.
So I understood that well, which obviously then helped me tremendous amount slicking through the military.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I was always a platoon sergeant or through all the training and everything, so I had it real easy. Mm-hmm. I knew everything was going on, and it was mm-hmm. just a breeze for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we're at the end of our time for this meeting, so let me go ahead and put an end on this real quick. Thank you very much, sir. This is on the first interview with Mr. Mike Ward.
All right, this is Steve Maxer continuing the interview with Mr. Mike Ward on the 9th of May 2003 at approximately 9:45. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Ward is in the Dallas area. But where exactly, sir?
Dallas. I'm physically in Dallas.
You are physically in Dallas today. All right, excellent. We are continuing the interview that we started at the 229 reunion in Charlottesville, Virginia. And today we're going to pick up with the discussion of your training. Sir, why don't we go ahead and start? If you would just tell me, you went to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri for your basic training, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. What were your first impressions?
Confusion, mm-hmm. obviously. Short hair.
Mm-hmm.
I think the normal things that anybody does when they first go into basic training. went into the entrance company, took the battery test, was a little bit bewildered. Remember that there were in that introduction company, I guess I'll call it for right now, there were two or three different times that we were, different people were called out. One of them was that I was notified that I qualified to go to landed school and turned that down. Mm-hmm. And then I was told that I qualified to go to explosive ordnance disposal school.
Mm.
And I listened to that, and I actually thought about it because it wasn't a increase of my time. In other words, at that time when you were drafted, you were in for 2 years and out. And in fact, it wouldn't have been an increase. It would have been a six-month training up east somewhere. I forget wherever the EOD school was at that time. But I was tempted because it sounded interesting, but I passed on going to EOD school and was then assigned to my basic training company. Was just there two or three days, and they sent everybody home for a Christmas leave because I went in the first part of December, and I think about the 10th of December they sent everybody home and said, you know, come back January 1 or whenever the date was. And so I went home after with the leave only in the Army about 2 weeks. Came back in January, and Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri was very cold in the wintertime, and went through a basic through basic training like everybody else. Since I had ROTC in college, obviously I was tagged for squad leader, and had the good and the bad that went with that. After basic training, I went to Fort Huachuca, Arizona, for field wireman school.
Okay.
I think it's 36K20 or 40 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I think, a 2 month school, something like that. And nothing significant happened out there.
Mm-hmm.
Just the normal AIT, more of a schooling atmosphere than a military atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a squad leader out there also, and I had a bunk room at that time with that guy's name was, I think it was Gene Foster, or his last name was Foster. He was a fullback with the San Diego Chargers. He was an interesting guy.
Oh, for crying out loud.
I remember he was so strong he could do push-ups with me sitting on his back. Just
wow.
He was a big guy.
Mm-hmm.
And started to learn a little bit more mechanically how the Army worked at that point in time.
Well, a real quick question. What did you find most challenging about basic training?
Nothing.
Okay. You felt you were physically fit, didn't have any problems?
Well, I wasn't any more or less physically fit than anybody else, and,
okay.
And as they increased and turned up the heat, on physical fitness, you know, I went along right with the rest of the group.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the end of basic, when you take your physical fitness test, about 3 days before that, we went on that last overnight field march. Was very, very, very sick. Went into the hospital. I had a light case of pneumonia. Was in the hospital 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
And pleaded with the doctor to release me out of the hospital because I knew if I didn't take that PT test that they would recycle me a couple of weeks, and they didn't want to do that.
Yes, sir.
And he said, well, Rush, he said, okay, go on and go. And I remember after 3 days in the hospital, I was so rested that I probably ran the fastest mile, did the best of everything, so it was really a little kind of a blessing.
Wow.
So I buzzed through that deal.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nothing physically or mentally challenging, I didn't think, at basic training. And
what about at Fort Huachuca? Was there anything particularly challenging about your training there?
No. Pretty straightforward stuff. Got involved, went to the, as part of the deal, went to the crypto school, which was kind of fun. It was interesting, different. That was a little little bit mental challenging, but not much. And I got a crypto clearance and learned how to use cryptographic equipment. That was kind of fun. But other than that, just basic stuff. And then after that was over, through no surprise whatsoever, I got orders to go to Vietnam, obviously.
Yes, sir. Now, the let's see. When did you go to Fort Huachuca? What time frame?
Time frame would have been probably April and May of 67.
Okay. Now, while you went through that training, and also when you were going through basic training, how much, first of all, how many of your instructors were Vietnam veterans that you knew of?
In basic training, both drill sergeants and I think the majority of all the drill sergeants were Vietnam veterans. The don't remember what his name was, the senior, we had an E5 and E6 drill instructor. And the E6 was a no-nonsense, just got back from Vietnam, no BS, just let's get through this stuff, guys, and the E5 was a little bit more gung-ho and all that, but basically got along fine with those guys. And as in the military, how it works, when you were a squad leader, you helped them make their life easier, so they made your life easier. So you started to learn that drill of how that works inside the military. But no, I didn't see anything challenging. I think it probably had to do with, at that point in time, they were jamming so many people into the service and drafting so heavy and needed so many bodies that I'm sure all things were relaxed just to move more gross people through the whole system. That's my guess on what was going on. And probably the same thing at Fort Huachuca. I don't think our platoon sergeants, or whatever he was called at that time, was I don't know if he was a Vietnam vet or not. I can't hardly remember his face. He wasn't, he lived in the barracks with us, I remember that, and we seldom saw him. His job was just to get us back and forth to classes, and that was about it. So that was kind of a non-memorable type thing as far as I can remember.
Okay. Now, would you recall anything very specific in terms of lessons that they try to pass on to you, knowledge that they tried to pass on to you concerning what it was going to be like for you in Vietnam? Because I would imagine they constantly reinforced, keep your head down, keep your butt down, and these things will save you in combat. Do you remember anything?
Absolutely not. I don't remember hardly anything specifically towards Vietnam in our training. It had to do much more with the specific skills. I do remember in advanced training, one of the things skills that I didn't know was map reading. That I became, matter of fact, I think they said that I was the only one that ever made a perfect score on the map reading contest going through that school. And to this day, I'm still very good at maps, and that did help me a tremendous amount over in Vietnam, understanding map reading and very quickly being able to look at a map and understand the contour and look out in front of me. But I think that has to do with my basic training as being an engineer and seeing in multi dimensions a flat topographic map and then looking at the terrain and seeing that. But with that said, mechanically, that was a skill that has helped me in a lot of other things in life.
Yes, sir. Okay.
But no Vietnam training specifically.
Okay. And at Fort Huachuca, was any of your training that you could tell, was any of it designed, tailored to specific environmental factors or combat factors that you'd encounter in Vietnam, whether it be jungle or whatever? Anything that you
Absolutely
remember?
Nothing.
Okay.
For sure, nothing.
Hmm. Well, when you left,
it was a technical training system.
It was purely technical.
That's all it was.
Okay, but of course, with communications, the technical is sometimes affected very significantly by the geographic, the weather, all kinds.
But in a sense, they gave just as much mm-hmm. technical training on how to handle the weather in sub-zero weather as they did 100-plus weather with high humidity. So,
okay. So they were preparing you for all environments.
There was no focus at all about Vietnam.
Interesting.
There was probably more focus in basic training when they had a rifle in hand and grenades and said, you better learn this, brother.
Mm-hmm.
But Fort Huachuca was strictly a technical-type training, and I think it's obvious that the Vietnam War was ramping greatly, and you heard numbers on graduating class that X percentage were going to Vietnam, then here's what percentage were going elsewhere.
Do you remember what those were, what the percentages were?
They were huge going to Vietnam.
I don't
remember exactly, but it was huge.
Yeah. Well, now, what was the composition of your classes? Basic training first, and then at Fort Huachuca. That is, especially the, I guess, how do you think you represented a cross section of American society, whether it be culturally, ethnically, racially?
There were few college graduates. Very small percentage, maybe I would say less than 10, maybe less than 5%. So in that, I was also probably a year or maybe even 2 years older than most of them there. Most of them were much younger. Again, as I told you earlier, I went through, I think, 3 draft notices that I got deferments on, so
mm-hmm.
I was picked up a little bit later than most guys my age.
Sure. Okay. Well, as you said, it was no surprise that you received orders to go to Vietnam.
Nope.
Did you know what unit you were going to be assigned to?
No, I didn't. I was, I didn't know that until I got to Thompson.
Okay. Did you get leave after your training at Fort Huachuca?
Sure did.
Yeah, and so you were able to go home and spend a month?
I think I got 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife was big as a balloon at that point.
Well, sure.
She was like 8 months pregnant, I think, or 7 months mm-hmm. right in there.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a nice, obviously she was pregnant when I went into the service.
Right.
And we had a nice 30 days together, and she ended up flying out. I went back to Kansas City where I was actually, I think, I was actually inducted through St. Louis, but
mm-hmm.
my family was in Kansas City.
Okay.
And she flew out to California with me
mm-hmm.
and spent the last week or 10 days out in California with me. And we went to Disneyland and all the normal stuff tourists do. And,
mm-hmm.
and then I think my reporting leave point was up around Frisco somewhere.
Okay.
And left out of there.
So what was the trip out in the flight, the actual flight out from San Francisco over to Vietnam?
We went on a military airplane.
Okay.
Did not go on a commercial airliner.
Mm-hmm.
Came back, I think, on commercial, but went over on one of the military planes that had the red nylon webbing in it, very uncomfortable. I remember we landed, I think, on Wake Island for refueling. At 2 or 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and everybody got to get off the plane and stretch your legs for an hour or whatever the number was. And I remember standing on a Wake Island and actually one of the runway points and looking to each side and seeing the waves hitting, and it started thinking about the guys who were on Wake Island during World War II and what they went through out there, and there were probably 6 or 8 guys, we were walking around and we bumped into a memorial. It was granite deals and a big piece of granite in the ground and a bronze plaque, and read the story about the Japanese coming in and attacking Wake and what went through, and it's just everybody, you know, was swallowing real deep, thinking, oh shit, maybe we're going to start going through the same kind of stuff.
Yes, sir.
And so we did our refueling and got back on the plane and headed for Vietnam. And I hadn't thought about that story till we just talked about it.
Yes, sir.
But I sure remember that evening, beautiful on Wake Island, and reading that bronze plaque about what those guys went through.
Mm-hmm.
So,
what was the atmosphere like on the aircraft itself? Was it all enlisted men mixed with officers?
It was a mixed group. Okay. It was a mixed group. I think it was. I'm not positive, but I think it was. And I remember when we got to Tansanute and the door of the airplane opened up and I felt this incredible heat, this incredible humidity, mm-hmm. and the smell of Vietnam. And so what in the name of God is this? And then when the doors got all the way open, they were hustling everybody off, and I scanned the runway and looked around and saw all these planes coming and going, and it was an absolute zoo. And went to some kind of a reception company area where they process people in. I was there a very short time, maybe hours. Mm-hmm. And I would say within 12 hours, maybe within 6 hours, I had a set of orders in my hand that said the 1st Air Cavalry Division. And there were a bunch of people that all got their orders at the same time to look at them. Where are you going? Where are you going? And somebody looked at me and said, you're going to the cab. And he just shook his head and I said, well, what's that mean? Mm-hmm. And this was I think he was a lifer. He knew what the cab was, and he said, "Do you know what that? You know what the air cavalry is?" I said, "No." He said, "Good luck, brother." And I thought, "Well, that's interesting. I wonder what this 1st Air Cavalry means."
Right.
I had no idea.
Oh goodness.
I had no idea. And so, within just a few more hours, we were on an airplane going to. K, Division Base Camp. So I would say within 24 hours, landed at Tansanute, got processed, got a set of orders cut, and went to K, and started the company processing in K, and probably happened even quicker, I would say within a few hours, knew I was going to B Company of the 229th Assault Helicopter Battalion. And they had about a three-day Vietnam orientation at Division Base Camp. And that's the first time I heard anything about any Vietnam combat, anything, on what was going on. And they had a three-day orientation. And I think they had it broken down two groups. They had grunts going to one orientation, and they had everybody else going to another orientation. And I went to the other orientation. Okay. The first time I ever saw an M-16. First time I ever saw an M-79 grenade launcher. First time I ever saw a LAW. So they showed you all these different weapons, fired a lot of the weapons. Looked at the Viet, you know, they went into the Vietnam, the jungle boots. Why these boots are different? Why you can't ever wear? You've got to wear this boot. If you got other boots, throw them away or confiscate them. You can't wear any other boots but these over here. Issued you all your jungle fatigues and that kind of stuff in your Vietnam gear. I do remember where. A lot of times you see in the movies when you're in basic training that they give you any clothes that fit and just tell you to keep on going. Well, here they gave me some clothes that were too tight, and I remember the guy looking at me and he said, "Don't worry, you'll fit into it real soon." I said, "What? I can't get in these things."
Oh,
and
funny.
I did. Because mm-hmm. When I went to Vietnam, I weighed probably 180 or 85 pounds.
Okay.
And when I came back, I weighed 131.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So, and matter of fact, that's another story about, they just about wouldn't let me come back because I was, as out processing, they picked up on that and said, Jesus. But anyway.
Well, what were they concerned about?
You know, I'm 6'1", that's
pretty skinny.
And they saw what my physical records were.
Yeah.
You know, when you go through and they check you for VD and everything else in your heart, you know, it's physical going back.
Right.
and they were very concerned.
Wow.
I was right on the edge.
How did you feel when you left, physically, while we're on that subject of your weight and your health? Did you feel like you were healthy, or did you feel like you had to get a break?
I was physically worn down pretty much, yeah.
Were you?
Okay. Yeah.
So, but back to the briefings that you received. And,
I remember one of the first big briefings, we sit down, and there's a stage, outdoor stage, and there's 500 guys there. I mean, hundreds anyway. Multiple hundreds are put through this thing. And they said, do we have any E2s out in the crowd? And a bunch of guys raised their hands, and I raised my hands. I was an E2. And they said, you have just been promoted to E3. And they all looked around and said, and somebody came up and just, you know, said, well, how'd that work? Well, I've been trying. Well, you got to understand over here, we want everybody to at least we can bust you down to something if you do something wrong. We want to torture you and punish you if you're not right.
Oh, no.
So I thought, well, that's a pretty good deal, because back in that time, it was, I think it'd be in the service for a year before you could be an E3. Pay grade wise, big issues like $80 a month or something more. It's a lot of money back then. I remember what I was making. I was making, went from like, you know, 220 to 300.
Wow.
That was a huge change.
Yes, sir.
Huge change. So I was real happy about that. And, but I thought, well, I mean, what do they worry about doing something wrong? Well, I didn't do nothing wrong. But anyway, so I was tickled about that. And, so you got your uniforms and sewing patches on and all that. And that's the first time I saw OD green and black patches rather than colored patches. That's when they were changing in the military. They used to have your name tag used to be white with black lettering. And, of course, the colors of the division patches and all that, well, that was all gone. And so now all the patches were OD and black. And so we got our things sewn up and got ready, and each night we would go back to our company area and report back the next morning for more stuff. And I think the last day, I said, well, we're going to take you out on a patrol. What's this patrol stuff? And they went out, and there must have been 100 people, and all with six M16s. And I remember going out there. They had web belts, and they had a full pack of everything, live grenades on you, which I was just really impressed with, that I had a couple grenades strapped to me. And don't remember how many bandoliers of ammunition. And as we're leaving this assembly area, somebody said, all right, magazine up. Everybody puts a magazine in. Well, this is really... Because back in the States, obviously, you didn't put a magazine in the weapon until you were ready to fire it. And so we loaded on deuce and a half and went out to the edge of the perimeter and went through the perimeter. And as we're going through the perimeter, one of the guys says, lock and load. And there's 100 guys going, all putting ammunition in. Wait a minute now. We're going to walk down a trail and everybody's got loaded guns? So we went out on a little walk in the woods or in the jungle for a few hours and fired our weapons, and we fired a law and that kind of stuff. And I guess that's when I was really thinking, this is a real deal. This is a real deal. The Army's not your walk around with a bunch of guys with loaded guns and grenades strapped on the side of you and had to make sure your canteen was completely full. And again, this was for the group of non-grunts. These were all non-infantry people. So this is the first time myself and many of the others had ever seen any of this kind of stuff.
Sure.
And so we were out most of that day and came back. And later I thought, this is the perfect place for the VC to ambush. Ambush a bunch of green guys that don't know their ass on the hole in the ground. They could take everybody out real quick. So anyway, we come back, and they said, you're released to your company now. So went back to my company area, and there were maybe one other person that had processed in with me at B Company, and each company inside the division had their own company area at division base camp.
Okay.
Much like the States, it had concrete floors for the hooch, wooden sides, screens, fold up, the typical jungle deal.
Mm-hmm.
And but actually, the barracks were in better shape than Fort Huachuca, Arizona was. There was, I think, a supply sergeant, and there was probably some kind of hard officer back there that took care of administrative matters, and I just heard about him lately. It's one of those guys that you just kind of lose. And we went, I think the next morning, I was on a helicopter going to Bong Song. And I remember the first time I stepped on a helicopter and was kind of at the edge, and when they pulled collective in it, and it pulled away from the ground very fast, I grabbed a hold of the seat, and it was a little bit unnerving, and then I realized, well, this is a pretty stable platform, and went up to Bong Song, and checked into the company area, and at that time, the company headquarters was right adjacent to the company operations bunker. And so I went and checked in, and somebody's looking at my records, and somebody said to me, can you type? And I said, well, sure. Well, about four people in ordering popped their heads up and said, he can type, he can type, he can type. Well, so what? Can't everybody type? And so the company clerk jumped up and went and got the first sergeant, told the first sergeant we got somebody just in that could type. And then the first sergeant came and drilled me about, well, can you really type? And I said, yeah. And he said, sit down and type something out there for me, young man. And it was ridiculous. I mean, and so pretty soon a captain came up, and his name was Daly. And he said, first sergeant tells me you can type. And I said, yeah. You can? Are you sure you can type? I said, yeah. He said, well, okay, that's all I need to know. And he nodded at the first sergeant. First sergeant said, you're going into operations. I said, what's an operation? I mean, is that a hospital?
Yeah.
No, flight operations. Okay. And he said, here's your tent. Here's where you're going to be sleeping, yada, yada. And you're supposed to be back here at 5 or 6 o'clock tonight. I said, what do you mean tonight? He said, be back here at 5 or 6 o'clock tonight. So I came back, and there was Captain Daly there, and he was a flight operations officer.
Okay.
And he said, we're putting you in flight operations. And then he started explaining to me what flight operations was. Mm-hmm. And First Sergeant came and Captain Daly, they said, what we really want you to do is do this, but we also want you to be CQ at night. And this might have been a day or two later, this was starting to evolve. And so I, within sight of a few weeks, started working in operations late in the afternoon, and then ended up, they changed the schedule, and I ended up being the CQ also. So I ended up being in flight operations and in charge of quarters at night. And I remember for the first several days, Captain Daly would come down late and say, are you sure you can stay up all night? And I said, what do you mean all night? This is daytime back in the States. I haven't changed yet.
Yeah.
So that was my introduction to how I ended up in flight operations, is because I could type and nobody else could, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an absolute perfect accuracy on times and locations and grid coordinations and yada, yada, yada. And if a digit's off, it can be catastrophic. But anyway, with that said, I started a process of learning what was going on in a flight company, and learned most of my skills from Captain Daly and other pilots, and there were some operations NCO type folks in the daytime, and some of those worked at night with me to break me in what was going on, and I did some daytime stuff. And I got to probably English by the 10th or 15th of July.
Mm-hmm.
Got to Vietnam by the 5th, and probably the 10th or 15th, I was out in English Bong Song. And was there maybe a week or 10 days. when I decided and got the courage that I wanted to go fly. And because in operations I could see what was going on, picked me a little log flight to go on and spent a couple hours one morning flying log and understood a little bit what was going on and had a good crew chief that kind of broke me in and showed me what the works of the door gunner were. And so from July until late October, early November, we were up in Bong Song alerting my flight operations training and flying about every third day. Sometimes I'd fly 2 or 3 days in a row if the company was real busy and there were a lot of flights going on. And I'd fly in the daytime and stay up all night. And one time I did this for about 3 or 4 days in a row, and I think maybe it was Captain Daly or the flight operations. Probably towards the end, it was actually probably in October, Walt Levering took over as operations officer away from Captain Daly. Okay. And finally said, "You hadn't." I was learning how to fly and sleep at the same time. Mm-hmm. After we take up off, my body would realize it's getting cool. We must be up at altitude. I can sleep now. As we'd start descending, going down into the LZ, get warmer, I'd wake up and, time to get serious again. So I learned how to sleep and fly in the daytime and work all night. Mm-hmm. And it was self-imposed poisoning. I didn't have to do this. It got to the point though that everything in Vietnam was people critical, and there weren't enough folks. I mean, and they were just jamming people through there, and we didn't have enough of anybody. There wasn't a The reason I got in operations, there weren't flight operations trained people to do such things, let alone it was a new skill. There weren't enough door gunners. There weren't enough anything. So a lot of people did a lot of different things. And English was a pretty... that was after the real bad things that happened up at English. Okay. And it had quieted down during that first 3 months. Some of our ships took a few hits. We didn't have any of the crew wounded. We didn't have any of the crew killed, obviously. We didn't lose any ships or no DX ships. We had some went down, but we're able to fix them all. So that initial point in time was a good time for me to get my feet on the ground, understand what flight operations was about, how the company worked. I do remember during that period of time that we were getting, we had a period where an awful lot of our folks were getting ill. And I basically was, I think I went to the CO, which was Varner, and said, "I think I know what the problem is, and I think it's our Lister bags." And he said, "What do you mean?" And I said, "Everybody walks up a Lister bag and puts their mouth down on the titty of it and takes a drink of water. And I think we're contaminating the bags." And he said, "Well, are you a, how would you know this?" And I said, "Well, just from my general training, I understand what's going on." And he said, "Well, what was your training?" I told him, he said, "Well, you're an chemical engineer. You're not a biologist or whatever." But bottom line, somehow, this went on for a day or two, and I mean, we had a lot of people sick. Like maybe 25 or 30% of our company was coming down with something somehow. Huh. And so, through a long series of events, I found some basic water testing equipment over in Cameron Bay. They let me off for a couple days, and I climbed on a flight, went over Cameron Bay, got the basic. This equipment came back, did some basic just biological screening before and after, and proved to everybody that it was the water bags, and they got rid of the Lister bags, and our company eventually within a few weeks got rid of them all in all the air group, as far as I know.
Wow. What did they replace the Lister bags with?
Don't even remember at this point in time. More a jerry can.
Okay.
The problem was the little tits on the end of the bag, the little plastic thing, they had. You put two fingers behind it and your thumb and get water. It was convenient just to bend over and get a drink of water out of it.
Yeah.
So So I think we just used the potable water jerry cans. You had to pour it out into something that stopped the problem.
Okay.
So anyway.
And then as a result, the illness, the number of illnesses went down?
It was over with.
Okay.
Stopped.
Cool.
And so shortly after that, in early November, a strange situation happened when we heard that the company was going to be divided. We listened and talked to some other folks in the air group and in the battalion, and nobody had heard of this before.
Okay.
But that the 4th Infantry Division and, the Big Red 1, I think, and the 101st was having a lot of contact and a lot of problems up at Khantoum. And that they were short on aviation airlift, and that the CAV was going to loan them 10 helicopters and the crews to go along with it. And B Company got elected to provide the 10 helicopters. And so we were told half of the company was going to Khantoum. We had 20 aircraft assigned to us, so that means 10 helicopters and 10 crews.
Okay.
That basically meant 20 warrant officers, 10 crew chiefs, 10 gunners. Now, what else are we going to send over Khantoum to support this? Half the company? Well, we're not sure how long we're going to be there. And actually, the first day they sent 6 because we didn't have 10 operational.
Mm-hmm.
And then inside of a few days, the rest of them came operational, and we ended up having 10 over there. Well, they ended up sending the company's maintenance officer, which was very good. We were always blessed with really strong flight maintenance people. One flight platoon sergeant, an E-6, I think his name was Smith, who was supposed to be in charge of the crew chiefs and gunners.
Mm-hmm.
And the first platoon was Ken Hamburger, and that flight platoon, which was about 20 warrants. And then Major Varner was over there most of the time, and me. So we didn't have a mess hall, we didn't have a motor pool, we didn't have the orderly room and the administrative side, we didn't have a supply, and we went to the Khantoum airfield, which was about 20 clicks south of Dak Tho. Khantoum airfield was also the Big Red One's northernmost major fire base from Pleiku.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a 3,000-foot runway there. And when we went there the first day, I remember that they said, where are we going to set up? And they said right over there, which was the northwest corner of the runway, and it was outside the perimeter. I said, what do you mean outside the perimeter? We want to set up. No, there's no room here. And so somehow we had 6 GP medium tents that came out of the sky from somewhere, which we're not sure where it even showed up. And so somebody said, well, what do we do? And I'm literally, there's a bunch of people standing around. I said, what do we do now? And so I said, well, let's start setting the tents. What do you mean? Well, we got to start setting it. Well, how do we do that? And so I started telling people what to do. And I don't think I really realized what was going on until Vel Varner at the reunion said, yeah, I remember we went up to Khantoum, you yelling at me, telling me that my tent was out of line, I had to remove it over to another area.
Hmm.
So what was happening was I had learned my skill. I knew everybody in the company, and they knew who I was, and there wasn't anybody else taking charge, so I was going to take charge of what was going on.
Okay.
And so I organized how the company street was going to get laid out and where it was at. And then we took our personal gear that afternoon, went on the other side of the barbed wire, and camped out for the night. 1 second.
Sure.
So the next morning, Major Varner said, "We need some things here. See what you can do about rounding up this and this and this and this and this." And I said, "Well, before we round that up, I think we need to get some barbed wire around this place and get another bunker built out here in the corner." And he said, "Well, yeah, you're right." I said, "Well, how do we do that?" He said, "Well, I'm not sure, but see what you can get done." So, bottom line is I found a CB unit, and I told them what we needed, and I quickly at that point in time, actually the first thing that happened was there were some more basic supplies we needed, like some food and water, and I went down to the supply dump, which was on the south side of the runway, and heard the sergeant that was in charge of this, and by the way, I had just gotten E4. I'd just been promoted to E4, I think, went up there, and I was happy with that $80 or $100 pay raise. And there was an E6 or E7 sergeant there running the supply dump, yelling at everybody and asking for requisitions. And I'm thinking, shit, I ain't got no requisitions. I ain't got nothing. But here's a list of stuff I need. Mm-hmm. And he was complaining to somebody about his CO that had to drive up to play coup the next morning, and he wasn't going to get here until 11 or 12, which means he couldn't get his work done. He had to put up with him all that next night because he couldn't get back to play coup in time. He couldn't get up because they had to clear the mines on the road every morning. So I was thinking, So I walked up and I said, "Sarge," I said, "I can take care of your problem about your CO." He said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "I can have him flown up tomorrow morning, have him here early in the morning, then you can get rid of him." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Who are you with?" And he looked down and said, "You're some of the cab guys." I said, "Yep." And I said, "We got choppers." And I said, "Have him at the VIP pad at Play Coup at 7 o'clock in the morning. The cab chopper will be there to pick him up, and he'll be here at 7:15, and we'll take him back at noon. How do you like that, Sarge?" He says, "And what can I do for you today?" And I said, "Here's what we need." And I told him that. And he says, "What else do you need?" I said, "I need some Constantino wire put up in the..." And he said, "I can't do that, but here," he said, "I can tell you who to go see over here at the CB. So I went over to CB station and put in my request for Constantino wire and some other stuff and soon recognized that they needed certain air things done. And within a few days, I had the barbed wire strung out and the new outpost built out there. And then I went to 4th Infantry and got them to staff the guard post, and I was doing all this by trading helicopter rides. Everybody needed something to be moved or somebody to be picked up and moved around. And since I was in flight operations, I was the guy that typed out the operations orders. And typically the orders would come down through division, through brigade, through battalion, down to company, and disseminated. But nobody ever asked me the legitimacy of anything I put on a piece of paper. And so early in the morning, before we would go out to Khantoum to the ABC place to pick up the grunts to go into combat assault, I'd send a ship down to be play coup to pick up a guy that we were here to get what done, to get done the things we needed to get done. Mm-hmm. And nobody ever asked me, number one, how did you get this barbed wire put up? Where did the food come from? How do we get the showers built by the CBs? Where do we get this? You know, nobody ever asked that. And that was probably head of Bill Clinton, "Don't ask, don't tell."
Yes.
Although I realized that if anything ever happened to anybody when they were out on these missions, mm-hmm. if a bird went down even, mm-hmm. if they even had a mechanical failure and a report was made on it, and what are they doing out there? And was ever traced back to me, I was in major, major heat, mm-hmm. regardless of why I did it. But being thinking, I'm an E4 in Vietnam, what are they going to do, send me to prison in the States somewhere? Mm-hmm. I'm joking, obviously, but it was just getting done what I had to get done. And at that point in time, there really wasn't anybody else there. There was no support. Now, we basically ate sea rations the whole time we were up there because we didn't have a kitchen or, you know, a mess hall or any, the normal stuff. We didn't have any normal support. And there was the first GP medium tent was, and I ended up putting some sandbags on the inside of it, about 6 foot square over in a corner, and my cot on the other side of where I slept in, and the field radios and so on, the mechanical tools of the operation, that's where we ran the operations out of. And typically, my day was 18 or 20 hours every day. I'd sleep a little bit in the afternoons. Mm-hmm. I was up most of the night with operations and then getting everybody gone in the daytime and doing the other mechanical things to support the other stuff that had to get done, the food and the log and the ash and trash and get water moved in and anything that had to be done.
Okay.
And I only got to fly, I think, two or three times. I think just two.
Mm-hmm.
And towards the end of it, and it was probably the most horrifying flying I ever saw up there.
Okay.
Somebody in the 173rd at that particular time, 101st, excuse me, made just some brain-dead decisions on where some pickup zones going into some combat assaults and resupplies were at and where the morgues were set up, and they were within side 30 yards of each other, or 100 yards, very close.
Mm-hmm.
And we were hauling dead bodies out of Khantoum like cordwood.
Oh, my goodness.
And bring them into a field morgue and stacking bodies up like cordwood. And there was stacks of bodies there. And just a few feet away, and, you know, we'd take 5 gallon buckets of water and swab the ship, blow the blood out of there. Over to hover to a pickup zone. Here's guys going in the field. And this was just, it was really a horrific thing that I saw, and I'll never forget it. Mostly, I'll never forget those grunts getting on the ships and how big their eyes were looking at the body bags.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of my real focused, most vivid memories of Vietnam, about like when the plane door opened at Thompson, and I said, this is what Vietnam smells like.
Mm-hmm.
So, and after that, I probably didn't want to fly very much anymore.
Yes,
that was a very horrifying experience to see that. And so we just pressed on with it, and I think we ended up staying up at Khantoum / Dak To a lot longer than anybody thought we had,
mm-hmm.
or were going to.
Mm-hmm.
And so probably we were there in November and December at the Khantoum airfield, or my portion of the company, when the rest of the company was still up at Bong Song. And then in early January, we were notified that Bravo Company was getting to go back to An K to provide lift capability for the Division Ready Reaction Force at An K. They always kept a company of helicopters, and which is 20, and a company of infantry at An K for Ready Reaction Force, just to protect the division base camp above and beyond everybody else. And they would basically rotate field units back in there for a week or 10 days to get rest and recuperate and get their stuff back together. And we needed that after Khantoum, just because there were so many flight hours going on and maintenance on ships. And the same thing with grunt units. It's gotten a lot of hours. They'd bring them back because basically I don't think An K was ever hit with any major force. There was always probe, but you couldn't get in that place with 10 divisions. So we went back to An K to get rested up, and that was a good thing. We were to go from there back up to English after our 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
And so they decided not to strike the tent, the camp at English, and not to bring all of our jeeps and that kind of stuff down.
Mm-hmm.
and our trucks and yada yada. So we were at on K for I don't know how many days, and about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, the field phone rang, and it was battalion flight ops, and they said, "Go get your CO up, get everybody up. We got a big one coming." And I said, "What's a big one coming?" "Get everybody up. We'll be back to you quickly, soon."
What was the date of this approximately?
This was approximately the 15th or 16th of January.
68.
Understand, Tet was the 31st.
Right.
So I went and got Major Varner up, and I said, "I don't know what this is about, but you're supposed to put on your pants and come down to flight operations. Battalion has got some hot orders coming down for us. I think the whole company's moving." He said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I'm not sure, but I'm telling you, nothing like this has ever happened before." So we went and got several other senior of the flight op, probably got Walt up, and probably got the other two platoon commanders up, and we all rubbed our eyes together and drinking some coffee and ops, and the phone rings again as battalion, and they said, "We've got a new missions for tomorrow, and the missions are to crank at 0500, head due north, and by six o'clock, you'll receive orders on this frequency of where you're going." I said, "Wait a minute, I'm going to go through this drill again now." Because down there, I was taking literally missions over the phone on unsecure lines. Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't remember what the drill was that I went through, but I knew this was not normal, uncalled for, and you can't just light up a ship, take off and head north, and they said, "We'll call you." But basically, that's what the mission was that day, and it was everybody. It was the, forget the exact terminology, but the air mobile operations portion of the company, okay. Which meant the flight crews and operations, and that's it.
Okay.
No cooks, no administrative, no anything. It was the flight crews and flight operations. Now, we also still had a few ships up at Bong Song that were down for maintenance. Mm-hmm. And so I started getting calling and talking to Bong Song, letting them know what was going on. In the meantime, more information starting to come down. But basically, we all fired up at 5:30 in the morning and started heading north, and it became obvious getting clearances out of On K that everything in On K was going north. Everything. And by the time we got to Bong Song, the sky starts getting black. I mean, light. And I remember looking over, and I think I'm sitting on my footlocker. Mm-hmm. I took two things, my footlocker and my chair, my aluminum chair with that nasty plastic webbing that went through it. Everybody had one. Mm-hmm. And I looked over and I saw a flying crane with this little box under it. And I asked the aircraft commander, the Peter Powell, I said, "You guys know what's under there?" And somebody said, "That's the division TOC." I said, "What's a TOC?" That's a tactical operations center for the division. And we saw another one, and another one had a box underneath of it. So the division commander was under a flying crane in his mobile operations center heading north, and the sky starts to become black with helicopters. And we had something in the neighborhood of 450 or 500 helicopters in with inside probably a several-click area, all heading north, and we knew we were going off the map because earlier, maybe at 5 in the morning, and and were scurrying around to get maps north of Way, because our maps all stopped at Way, and we knew on a coordinates it was north of Way by that time. And somehow we did find two or three maps. And I remember Walt was an aircraft commander and operations officer at that point. And I basically always flew with operations officer. Whenever he flew, I'd fly with him. And so we're chatting back and forth on the radio, and it's obvious that this is really something big. I mean, they're moving every helicopter in the division. Wait a minute. They took all the 105s with them, too. All the Chinooks, base, and all the grunts. Mm-hmm. We hauled the grunts, the 105s, mm-hmm. and all the air assets. And went north. All the grunts didn't go the first day. All the artillery didn't go the first day. But by the second day, some of them made round trips and went back and picked them all up. So by the second day, which would have been the 16th or 17th, we were all north. The whole division, 250 miles of all the combat arms of the division. And we went into a place called Tombstone, which was LZ Tombstone, which was about 15 clicks northwest of Way. And it was called Tombstone because it was the old imperial graveyard of Vietnam, of the old, one of the old dynasties. And it was quite recognizable. And that was either on the 16th or 17th. And I remember that night when we started setting up, there wasn't any concertina wire out there, and somebody made the bright decision, you know what, we got all these helicopters sitting in this field, there ain't any concertina wire around it. So we're going to take all the helicopters into Wei Fu Bai and log her all night, and we'll come back the next morning. I'm thinking, now, wait a minute, there ain't nobody left but me and a few other guys out here. There was maybe, with the division, there maybe was 200 people that didn't go into Wei Fu Bai that first, for about 3 nights. Took a little while to get some kind of perimeter set up, not long, maybe 3 days at the most, mm-hmm. and they had barbed wire and primitive outposts and bunkers, and they had a perimeter set up. And but for two or three nights, the first night there was nothing. We were just out in the middle of the graveyard, and the second night wasn't much better. Third night there was a perimeter established all the way around. And we realized that, you know, we're playing grunts. And by the way, so by the 21st or 22nd, we had a division base camp up there. And by that time, all of the grunts were there, three brigades of grunts. All their artillery was there. By the 22nd, 23rd, 24th, we had a couple outlying fire bases lined up with 105s and some company battalion-sized grunts around them, trying to put up some base security around that, some interlocking fire. And just a few days later, we're sitting up on the tombstones looking down. Literally, it was 1,800 feet above Way, and you could easily see into Way at night. And we're saying, you know what? These Vietnamese really know how to celebrate their New Year's. Would you look at all the fireworks going on down there? Man, that's pretty cool. And boy, the radio started humming. Mm-hmm. And that was the start of Tet. It was abundantly clear to all of us up there at that point in time why the cab was put in between Way and the DMZ. They had no idea we were there. Wow. They had some. Yeah. But the big picture, they did not have real good communications. Mm-hmm. And so that night, as the order started coming down through division, through 11th Air Group to the 229th, the CAV's main mission was to retake all of the bridges from Highway 1 from the DMZ down to Way. Okay. The first night, they had Highway 1. It was theirs. And that next day was the first day we ever saw large amounts of bodies out in the open. Mm-hmm. They were literally marching down Highway 1 in what we would call a parade fashion, in company-size units, dress right dress and AKs on their shoulders and fresh uniforms. And I remember we're going on a combat assault, and popped over the radio. Did you just see what I? Yeah, we saw. Well, it was that morning we were on a 6+2 combat assault into a bridge, and here is at least a company size 120 to 150 NVA. Brand new uniforms, brand new AK-47s, marching down the highway four abreast. And they saw the flight of 6+2 go over them. And most of them raised their heads up and looked at the helicopters. And the gun said, "I don't believe this." And they peeled off and came down. And after the first pass of the two gunships, there were maybe 8 or 10 guys still standing up. As I looked down there, I saw those guys are in awe. And about that time, on the other side from the crew chiefs, they were all firing their weapons, and those 8 or 10 guys were gone. And that day we saw more of them marching up and down the highway, and the next morning we saw a few of them, but never again. Mm-hmm. It took them about a day to realize that you don't just stay out in the open with helicopters running over your heads. They were that green coming across the DMZ. They had not had very good training about what do you do when you see a helicopter come. And we got a lot of them those first few days. And I think it took us about 3 or 5 days to completely resecure Highway 1. Mm-hmm. Now, we resecured Highway 1 and cut off their main supplies going into Way, which they thought they were going to be running trucks down into Way for resupply, and we stopped that. Because there was a lot of Air Force stuff up on the DMZ in North working out on physical truck convoys that were supposed to resupply the groups that were in Way and all over the rest of the country. Mm-hmm. So we spent the rest of January at Con Tomb, and at Tombstone. Mm-hmm. And then in February, we moved to a new Camp Evans, which was north of Tombstone. Okay. we were still well within sight the Tet Offensive at that time. Mm-hmm. We were also involved, and the Marines and I think it was 101st really took a lot of heat and way. I remember when we'd fly in there, we'd see a lot of the old M48 tanks, the American old-style tanks, right up next to the wall of the Imperial City, or of the Citadel. And they would run those tanks up the wall, and Charlie would throw Molotov cocktails off on the porch. And it was an ugly scene. And the CAV was involved on the very last days as the Tet was falling apart, we inserted a company right in the city center of the Citadel and worked our way out instead of the Marines were on their outside trying to work their way in. And I think in 24 hours we retook the Citadel and it was over. That was another thing where the Marines really felt like the CAV was rubbing stuff in their face. Mm-hmm. It was a tactics issue. Mm. Where they were fixed bayonets charged up the hill. We would call artillery into the top of the hill, air assault the top of the hill, and walk down the hill. Mm-hmm. So it was a tactics issue. So we were up at, by this time we're at Evans Forward Base Camp. This is when Cobras first started coming in big numbers into the CAV. Mm-hmm. And we were getting resupplied with Cobras, which was a big advantage for us. Helped us out a lot. And we were in Evans in February. That's where... Remember I told the story about Rocky and the ammo dump going off? And that's where that happened at Evans.
Oh, okay.
That's the ammunition cooking off. And was only there about a month. And I one of the things, being an operations person, I was basically excluded from all other duties. I didn't pull guard duty. I didn't pull any duties because operations was basically a full-time, always going.
Yes.
Every hour of the day you're up, because that was the nerve center and control of the whole company, what was going on a tactical basis. Mm-hmm. And I was in operations, and one of the other ops guys came in and said, First Sergeant says, you got to come outside, there's a problem. So, fuck, what's this? Mm-hmm. So I'm going to come outside, and there's a big formation, and the First Sergeant said, come here, Ward. And he got out there, and he starts eating my ass out about something. And he said, well, since we can't get you straightened out, I guess we got to promote you. You're now an NCO, and gave me my sergeant stripes, where everybody else guffawed and all that kind of crap. Right. And so I went back to the operations tent, and they said, you make sure those are on your sleeves by tomorrow morning, CD out top. So I got my stripes in, at Evans, and that was like 6 months. So I go over to Vietnam as an E2. Automatically promoted E3 when I get into the division. I was E4 in like 4 months. As a buck sergeant, 6 months or seven. By that, and any time after Khon Tum, pretty much the officer group stayed out of the decision making process and operations. Typically, what was supposed to happen was, as the missions came down, operations would sift through what helicopters were available as far as how much maintenance, how many hours it can still fly, what the missions were probably going to require that day, what crews were available. And then basically the platoon leader from the officer group would post crews to the ships after operations did that. And then the platoon sergeants from would post the gunners because, of course, the crew chief stayed with the ship all the time. But really what would happen was they would do that, then operations would change things to make things fit a little bit better. And typically there were also a lot of missions came down late at night, changes made, and I would just change them. And Captain Hamburger didn't like me at all.
Really?
No, he didn't like me.
Okay. What gave you that impression?
Well, it wasn't an impression. I mean, there was a lot of arguments about me doing things that was unauthorized. And I mean, I would just change things at night. He would, you know, like post what crews he wanted on a ship for a certain mission.
Okay.
And I'd get everybody up the next morning, and there was nothing changed.
Okay.
And by this time, we had a new flight operations officer named Dave Nesset. He was a first lieutenant.
Okay.
And Walt was operations officer for about 3 months. And Dave Nesset probably became operations officer about when I became a buck sergeant. And so I was doing my normal thing of changing around things in the middle of the night. And crews, helicopters, missions, whatever it was. And my typical hours were I would come in about 4:30 or 5 in the afternoon and stay till 7 o'clock the next morning, or 8 o'clock the next morning.
Mm-hmm.
And so this particular evening, Hamburger comes down to the operations bunker and starts drilling me about why I did this or I did that. And Dave Nesset stood up and said basically, you know, tried to protect me in some ways. And about that time, Rocky Lane was now our company commander. And Colonel Brown, lieutenant, was the battalion commander, walked into the operations, coming over the operations board. Captain Hamburger is just eating my and First Lieutenant Dave Nesset's ass out about that. And Lieutenant Nesset says, well, that's his presumptive authority to do those kind of things. And Major Lane and Colonel Brown heard this for about 10 seconds, battalion commander says, presumptive authority, huh? And then that stopped Hamburger cold in his tracks, and they said, something about the missions the next day and what was going on and operational readiness and that kind of stuff. But there was always an issue with doing things outside of the stateside way of doing things. And so, yeah, when you ask what made me think that, not think, it's obvious. I mean, I was...
you were usurping his authority.
Oh, shit, everybody's. It was done my way. I was the first my way or the highway. But really nobody understood it. Nobody had the slightest comprehension about really what was going on there. It was just too many things for... Everything was cause and effect. So with all that said, and there was a lot of politics between what... There was a big political issue about good and bad pilots. Mm-hmm. A lot of pilots wouldn't fly with other pilots. There were certain pilots you could put on certain missions because of their skill levels.
Okay.
And that caused a lot of friction between some of the officers. Well, I took the friction. I changed them.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of dynamics going on in those kind of things. Who I told you earlier about the guy that trained me in operations, Captain Daly, he was a walking disaster. He shouldn't have ever got wings. He was scary.
Wow.
And he could only fly. And there were other pilots who were like that. And he had to be very careful on who they flew with. And then there were some good pilots that just wouldn't fly with those guys, or they would call, so, and crews, so. And I understood the dynamics better than anybody.
Okay.
And most people then understood I knew the dynamics. It all worked out. Just shut up and stay out of his way.
Interesting.
And I was a buffer sometimes between those things. So anyway, that's why I said Captain Hamburger didn't really like me very much.
Okay.
In early March, the next probably big significant thing happened was Quezon and the relief of the Marines up there on the 1st of April.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very significant time. Tet was over in February, and we jumped right into Quezon. That was the tail end of Tet, obviously.
Yes, sir.
Or the start actually of a new thing, I think.
But before we talk about Quezon, first of all, let me pause the recording equipment for just a minute.
Okay.
First of all, what was your unit strength before Tet actually started in early January of 68? Do you recall?
You mean we would be considered, typically we were about 75% mission-ready aircraft.
Okay, which would count, which include how many aircraft and personnel?
We were assigned 20 aircraft.
Okay.
We had about 40 warrant officers.
Okay.
About 6 or 8 hard officers, 45 warrant officers. About 6 hard officers,
mm-hmm.
a platoon leader for each of the 2 5 platoons, XO, CO, maybe somebody else in there for something.
Mm-hmm.
Maintenance officers, the maintenance officer was always like an W3 or W4.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the warrants also had extra duties. One of them might be the motor platoon officer or, the communications officer. They had extra duties that they traded around.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had, obviously, 20 crew chiefs and then anywhere from maybe just 10 or 15 gunners. We were always short on gunners.
Okay.
So, but we had typically a full complement.
Mm-hmm. So the total number
cooks,
of people...
motor pool.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Maybe 120,
okay.
130 people.
So
20 helicopters.
Yeah, about the same size as an infantry company.
Right,
so 125, 130 people.
Right.
What was the supply system, logistics system like, and maintenance?
Two maintenance. You had helicopter maintenance and motor maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Motor pool, there was a warrant officer in charge of the motor pool. There was a motor sergeant, 2 or 3 motor guys. We had 1 5-ton,
mm-hmm.
2 deuce-and-a-halves. About 4 ton-and-a-halves, half dozen jeeps, 4 mules.
Mm-hmm.
And I might be off 1 or 2 vehicles on the
yeah.
1 1/4. That was about our motor pool.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe 2 mechanics, motor mechanics, maybe 2. Maybe only 1, I'm not sure.
Okay.
And then the flights had either a W-3 or W-4 in charge of aircraft maintenance. And he had two or three specialists. He had a transmission specialist, an engine specialist, and an avionics specialist. And that was about it. And then the crew chief, obviously. Mm-hmm. So that was the maintenance side. Then there was the first sergeant, obviously, ran the administrative side of the company, and he had a couple of company clerks. There was a supply. I think the supply sergeant pretty much stayed back at the division base camp. And he would get stuff moved forward as we needed it. And there was maybe one or two supply clerks that got stuff moved around. There was a mess sergeant, you know, four or six cooks. There was a communications unit that I should have been in that handled the radios and telephones. Communication stuff with the company, mm-hmm. the antennas and all that kind of communication stuff, and that was the company.
Okay. And what were there any supply problems or shortages of equipment, materials at all?
There's always, you know, mm-hmm. nothing horrendous.
Okay, nothing that prevented aircraft or vehicles from being. Kept.
Yeah, well, sure there were. We always had stuff we were short on. Okay. Never had everything all the time.
Okay.
Other than not running out of washings, sea rations or water, we ran out of all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. We always had, you know, that. Water, sea rations, and ammo we were okay on all the time. Other than that, we were always short of this or heavy on that. Of course, I don't think we ever ran out of beer either, but that was a personal supply issue that we kept in order.
Okay. And let's see. Prior to Tet, what was the initial enemy that the unit would encounter out in the field? Was it NVA VC combination?
Wong Song was definitely VC.
Okay.
Definitely VC. Mm-hmm. A little bit of NVA. The group just before us really decimated the NVA pretty bad down in the Central Highlands.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the NVA had retreated back west into Laos, Cambodia. As we went up north, obviously the complexity just changed instantly. And much more aggressive NVA at that point up north, much less VC.
Mm-hmm. The tempo of operations prior to Tet, did over the course from the time you got there in country to the time, say around mid-January of 1968, would you describe the tempo of operations between you and the enemy units that you encountering and engaged? Did it increase, decrease, stay the same?
I would say English from July until October mm-hmm. was rather steady,
okay.
mostly VC,
mm-hmm.
no major engagements. Kontum was Kontum Dokto / we were Kontum, but the fight was at Dokto,
mm-hmm.
was absolute, probably the worst. It was really bad on the ground wise, not aviation wise, but ground wise was really bleak.
Okay,
that's where we're stacking the bodies like cordwood.
Mm-hmm.
So that November December was very very intense. That was all NVA. 90%, I think, NBA.
Mm-hmm.
And then, obviously, there was a stand down for our company at Anke for those 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
And then as soon as we flew north to Tombstone, it rolled back into NBA again.
Okay. What were your aircraft losses before Tet?
We didn't have one.
You didn't have any aircraft loss?
I mean, lost.
Shot down.
Oh, that's a different story.
Okay. Yeah, not necessarily completely destroyed, but yeah, let's clarify.
Couldn't count. Lots
shot down.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Typically small arms fire, or were there any 12.5 or?
No, that didn't come until much later.
Or 12.7, excuse me.
Mm-hmm. That didn't come until much later.
Okay. And how about the size of a typical enemy that your unit would engage prior to that? What was the average unit size?
We were always, a typical combat assault was 6 plus 2. A big one was 6 plus 2 plus 2, which would have been 6 lists, 6 guns, excuse me, 6 lists, 2 guns, and 2 ARAs. And then a real big combat assault would be, typical combat assault would be a 6 plus 2 with a tube prep. Mm-hmm. In other words, it would be prepped by artillery. Mm-hmm. Then the gunships would take over. And then as the list ships went down, then the door gunners would take over. Mm-hmm. On a little bit hotter area, they would do tube and ARA prep, where they tube prep it, then 4 minutes out, ARA would work out for 2 minutes. They would expend. The gunships would take over for the next 90 seconds. In the last 30 seconds, the list ships would sit down with their door gunners work. Mm-hmm. So it depended on the day what the size of the lift and the operations were, on how big the combat assaults were. Mm-hmm. But typically, most of the combat assaults were 6 plus 2, and there were some 12 plus 2s. The big ones happened up north, not down south. Mm-hmm. They got really big up north. Mm-hmm. So I would say the area of operations changed because of the locale, physicality of the supplies from the DMZ and the Ho Chi Minh Trail up north. Mm-hmm. They had more to fight with, tanks, you name it.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Well, during the Tet Offensive, I would assume that given the heightened activity, that you guys probably lost the definition of lost now meaning completely destroyed as opposed to the previous meaning of just shot down. But did you completely lose any aircraft during Tet that were utterly destroyed by enemy fire?
We had some that were later red X'd after we got them back. I mean, we got them back, but then they decided they were such a bad case, we'd just scrap them.
Okay.
A few.
Mm-hmm. During the course of this period, did any pilots get captured or crew members get captured after their aircraft were shot down?
No.
Okay. How about prior to Tet? No one was captured?
Nope.
Excellent. Okay.
The ships seldom ever went out by themselves, always in groups.
Right.
And when a ship went down, it was like a magnet. Everybody was instantly there. I was just thunderstruck during the Iraqi war where the gun went down and nobody went in after him. Mm. That never. It didn't matter how heavy the fire was. We just kept stacking them up. In other words, we get one shot down, we come in and get another one shot down, then another one, until we got them out of there. Didn't stop.
Mm-hmm.
To my recollection, I don't ever remember a ship going down and we knew it was down and wouldn't go in there. We just kept coming.
Mm-hmm. Well, what were your personnel losses like before Tet?
We had several minor wounds. We lost a few people to wounds. Mm-hmm. No, nothing great.
Okay.
Small numbers.
How about during Tet?
Same. We lost a few people mm-hmm. on minor wounds. Some of them left the company and went to the hospital. Some came back. Some didn't. Not big numbers, though.
Okay. When you say not big numbers, could
less than a handful.
Okay.
But we had lots of holes in ships.
Yes.
And our mission ready numbers went way down.
Okay. Because
probably from 70% down to 40%.
Wow.
Because we had, you know, just they were torn up all the time.
Wow.
74. We were over 75 most time, but we're probably less than 50 there towards the end because we just got lots of holes.
Okay. Now during the during your first six, I think it's about 6 months in country, the last half of 67, was there very much emphasis on getting body count in your unit? You know, making sure that reports were going up chain of command with good numbers indicating success in the battlefield.
I think that happened more on the grunt level than on the aviation level, although the gun companies did take that into account.
Okay.
And they like to count.
What about during and after TED? Did that change at all?
That isn't my knowledge. I'm not sure. I don't know how that worked.
Okay. Just curious. Since you worked in operations and, of course, a lot of operational reports.
Well, I saw them, and I remember them going through, and it really wasn't an issue to me.
Yeah.
I was mostly interested in the very last pages of the sit reps on prisoner interrogation. Those were always fascinating to me to read those.
Well, did prior to TED, did your unit capture very many prisoners?
Well, helicopter units aren't in the business of capturing.
No.
We haul them after the grunts capture them. But that was a constant deal.
Okay.
Yeah, I was in a ship one time. One just jumped out on his own.
Oh, for crying out loud!
I mean, we didn't push him; he jumped out.
Oh, wow.
there was an Arvin interpreter, and he was putting the hard screw. We had two of them in the ship, and I think the Arvin interpreter had a rag around the guy's neck, and he was choking him, one of the prisoners, and. Mm-hmm. And the other one said, I think he just thought he was either jumping. I don't think he knew what he was doing, and he just jumped out.
Oh, for crying out loud. Did you guys go back for him?
No. I mean, we were probably at 1,500 or 1,800 feet when he jumped out. He hadn't been on a helicopter before.
Oh, goodness. Well, you mentioned, you qualified that very specifically with he jumped out on his own. The implication being that there may have been instances where they might have been assisted.
I never saw that.
Okay.
I heard, you hear stories, but
right.
I never saw that.
Right. Okay. Did your unit work closely with Arvin before TET?
Oh yeah.
Especially
in Bong Song.
Okay. What was your impression of them, of the Arvin?
I remember the first. Jesus. This is another one of my snapshot memories. It's really the strongest. The first group time we ever took Arvin's on a combat assault, we would always haul six grunts. Well, with Arvin's, we would haul eight. And I always thought that was interesting, but it was eight plus chickens and pigs and... No, I swear to goodness.
I know.
They would take pigs, little piglets. They would take chickens, goats.
Mm-hmm.
I always remember their combat assaults were never into the type of combat assaults we had.
Mm.
They would, unload. It was more like log missions and combat assaults.
Mm.
I don't ever remember taking an Arvin unit into a hot LZ.
Wow.
Mm. Sure, that happened, but never when I was. Again, I flew every third or fourth day, so. On the average.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe they did go on hot LZs, but I was never on one where they did that.
Wow.
Now, although the Arvins were up north and were heavily involved in Way especially, I don't have a lot of recollection of them. I just remember all the crap they used to take in with them, and they didn't. It seemed like the missions they got were very intense missions.
Mm-hmm.
That's my recollection of the Arvins.
Prior to going to Vietnam, what was your opinion of what the United States was trying to accomplish there?
I probably didn't have an opinion.
Okay. How about after you got there? What was your opinion of what the United States was trying to do there?
I would say I probably didn't have an opinion until a little bit into... I guess the only thing that really galvanized my opinion on Vietnam, good, bad, or indifferent, was...
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was later, after actually January, where they had their first elections.
Okay.
And that particular, I think we were either at Evans or Sharon, which would have been February, March, April, somewhere like that.
Mm-hmm.
And one afternoon I took a Jeep and went in. Oh, wait a minute, this could have been a Bong Song. Let's forget the date. But anyway, I decided to go into town to do something. And... remember driving down the dirt road, and there was a bunch of people lined up from one of the huts, and they were lined up to vote. And I went by maybe 50 or 75 yards, and a grenade went off in that line of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I stopped and turned around. Well, there was an MP Jeep coming the other way. Well, the MPG got there right away. So I just pulled and watched that was going on, and I turned around and came back and kind of was just snooping to see what was happening. And somebody just laid a grenade in the voting line, and about 15 minutes later, they hauled off two or three bodies, and by that time, an Arvin MPs got there, and everybody just got back in line and to vote. And I thought, you know, I don't believe in the states that happened, anybody get back in line again. And probably after that point in time, I saw a little bit different about, were we over there for a just reason? Because I think most of the people down deep inside didn't want to vote. Now, maybe they wanted to vote us out, did or did not, but they wanted to vote. And so I could appreciate that. And to this day, that's another vivid recollection of that going on. Those folks getting back in line after that grenade went off. With no prompting, they just did it.
Interesting. Did you understand? You think you understood what the United States was trying to do there?
I'm not sure whether they did or not at that point in time. I heard the reasons and the rhetoric at that point in time. Mm-hmm. But my analyzation was only what I could see.
Okay.
And I saw a obviously inept Arvin, you know, military.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand what was going on with the government. I saw what we were doing, and I thought that was a reasonably good thing to do, and understood the domino theory,
mm-hmm.
and believed that to be reasonably correct, and which is a whole other story.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, I didn't have any principal issues with Vietnam at all. And after that little grenade incident and the voting, I was very comfortable from that point on about why we were there.
Okay.
Much like Iraqis now, they might want to vote us out, but that's okay as long as they're in control of their future.
Yes. Sure. When Ket hit, and get back to the specifics, some of the specifics of what you were saying earlier, this didn't come as a surprise at all, really, to your unit. You guys...
Well, no, wait a minute. It came as a surprise to my unit. In retrospect, it was obvious why they had moved us up there. We didn't know why we moved, why we jumped through our ass.
Right.
But, boy, it was real clear a few days later
mm-hmm.
that they knew something the fuck big... Now, could it have been as part and parcel of the Enclave defense, too? Yes.
Mm.
As you well know, part of... Westmoreland wanted a mass assault onto Anke. They were praying for it. And with a cab about less than 30 flight minutes away to support them, which in what happened later on, the cab was in a good blocking position to happen to control anything going on up there at that point in time. But without us being up there, It could have had a different outcome, very possibly.
Now, when you, let's see. Is there anything else prior to helping to provide relief at Quezon? Is there anything else that you want to discuss?
No, except it took about 10 days or 2 weeks to get all of our stuff up north. That came up in a convoy, ground convoy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and then discuss the next phase of Tet, your participation in Tet and Caesar Quezon for your unit.
Yeah, Quezon was a... Tet had basically wound down. It was clear at that point in time they weren't going to do what they wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
That we were in control of the country again in general. And we were moving back into more of a normal type of combat operations. And obviously Quezon was the news leader for a huge period of time. And we didn't quite, we being Army, didn't quite understand the Marine tactics. This was an ongoing thing always, why the Marines didn't do things and we did one thing. I mean, our companies, and I'm sure you've heard the story many times, we supplied Marines on an unscheduled basis constantly because they couldn't even get resupplied. Mm-hmm. Had more to do with their tactics and their equipment than anything else. But so we realized, we knew what was going on at K-Sign. We knew how bad it was. Mm-hmm. And we probably knew for 2 days operational-wise we were going into K-Sign. So there was a lot of planning. Usually I don't think we had that much notice, but we knew we were going into K-Sign. Mm-hmm. And I know I mentioned to you the story about the night before you saw the picture of Rocky with the case of beer. Mm-hmm. We took our onion skin papers and made lots of little typewritten things. Have no fear, the cab is here.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Come out of your hole, the cab is on patrol. Uh-huh. And made many, many thousands of those. And the first ship over Quezon that morning, we dumped them out, and it was interesting to see the Marines crawling out of their bunkers as they were being mortared and rockets coming in. Mm-hmm. They were kind of numb to it by that time and would pick up these little pieces of onion skin paper and scratch their heads and look up in the air. And the first day, first 2 or 3 days of the operation was not to secure Quezon, but again by cab tactics, securing all the high ground around Quezon. Mm-hmm. And we assaulted all of the hilltops. We took over 2 or 3 of they did have some outposts, but we quickly took those over. Actually took the Marines back to Sharon. Oh, and by the way, in March is when we moved into Sharon. We moved into Sharon the first, actually very end of February, and then immediately camp wasn't even done, went into this. But then started bringing the Marines back to Sharon for base security, which kind of worried us that the Marines would now be pulling base security at an Army.
Yes, sir.
LZ, because we saw how close they, you know, what they did over there, again, tactics-wise. Didn't last very long, but they were back for several days because we gutted all of our base security at Evans and Sharon, put a lot of troops out in the field around Quezon, but for several days just took all the hilltops and combat assaulted those and took lots of prisoners. Lots of prisoners we took then. Then probably 4 or 5 days later, I actually went in and had an orderly takeover at the firebase. And didn't stay there very long, though. I'm not sure exactly when, but maybe a week later they shut down the firebase and the cab left.
Okay.
It was a symbolic thing. Mm-hmm. It was a symbolic issue. North Vietnamese were driven back across the border. They couldn't freely move up and down their trenches. This is, again, Marine tactics just didn't quite work there very well.
Right.
And air mobile tactics clearly took charge of what was going on. Well, that's our story, and we're sticking to it anyway. You talk to the Marines, they got a different story, and they're going to stick to it.
Yes, sir. Was the... It seems like a lot of the rivalry, if you will, between the CAV and the Marine Corps was tongue in cheek.
We felt sorry for them, though.
Yeah.
It's pitiful. They didn't have good equipment. They didn't have good tactics. They didn't have good supply. I think they were well trained. They're good American soldiers, but. If you would have put those Marines in with Army assets, Army tactics, I just think they would have been a lot better off. Mm-hmm. Marines typically, when they made contact, would fix bayonets, throw hand grenades. The CAV, when they made contact, they would pull back in, call in artillery, mm-hmm. then engage. So So there's a major tactical difference when they were out in the field how they did things.
Yes.
And that's an oversimplification, but indeed that's exactly what did happen.
Was there very much, working in operations, I would imagine, you had to coordinate or help coordinate activities, support with other branches as well, the Air Force in particular for close air support, maybe even the Navy for that, Navy for, well, I guess you were probably too far inland.
No, not at all.
Oh, you did get naval gunfire?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Sure.
What was the...
Especially on the lightning bug missions.
Okay.
We were there when the New Jersey was there.
Okay.
We worked with the Boston, which was even more outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
Boston had radar control 8-inch guns that were automatically loaded.
Mm-hmm.
Their cyclic rate was very high.
Mm-hmm.
So especially on we'd use them a lot of times with bug missions at nighttime.
Okay.
And we did get involved with that coordination, yes.
Excellent. What was the relationship like between your unit and the Air Force and then your unit in the Navy?
The Navy and the Army speak different amounts of coordinates.
Mm-hmm.
There's a problem there. Mm-hmm. Army typically deals in 6 digits
mm-hmm.
on a map, which is 100 meters off, and Navy works in 8 digits, which is 10 meters.
Mm-hmm.
There was some of that coordination problems. But in general, it was positive.
Mm-hmm.
Same with the Air Force. There were forward controllers that specifically worked between combat assaults and the fast flyers and to put all those issues together, which didn't happen at the company operations level.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever in want of support from in any mission that is you really needed close air support but just couldn't seem to find any?
Maybe in the Ashall Valley, we wish we had a lot of things would have happened different there.
Okay. That happened later in 68?
It happened, yeah, in the Ashall Valley.
Mm-hmm. But this is after Tet?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. But not before Tet or during Tet?
Well, I think if you talk to ground units, they never had enough support.
Right, but in terms of, because you guys had, an infantry element with you, so the Blues.
Well, we typically,
you also had internal support, that is the gunships.
The 229th had a company of guns.
Yeah.
And those guns typically were in support of either our combat assaults
yes.
or radio reaction force or directly gun missions.
Right. So that helps a lot.
So did we ever wish we had more guns? Of course.
Right. But it reduces your reliance on external support for those.
No, we had it internal.
Yeah.
And like I say, if a ship was down in the area of operation, it was really quick. First of all, there were more lift ships around there. There were guns immediately. They just stop what they're doing and go, you know. You were never in thought process how long I'm going to be out here by myself.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, what else do you remember about the siege of Khe Sanh and the ending, the ultimate relief that was brought to the Marines? And
I thought it was kind of like a skyrocket going off. Looks great going up, and then poof, and it's all over with. Where's the rest of the show?
Mm.
I mean, they were gone.
Mm-hmm.
They melted back into the mountains so fast, so quick. You know, afterwards you could see this tremendous infrastructure of tunnels and ditches and all that crap they dug, and they were within just, you know, very close, within hand grenade throw. A lot of the trenches were getting on the perimeter of Khe Sanh. It was amazing. It was amazing, and the Marines let them dig up, or we say they let them dig up to do that. That's what I was probably most amazed about, tactical differences.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing the CAV would have done it differently.
Mm-hmm. Well, after that portion of your involvement in Tet ended, the siege of Khe Sanh was over, and where did your unit go from there? Where did you shift focus?
Well, basically, we right during that period of time, we moved from Evans to Sharon, which Sharon was about 15 clicks north of Evans. So we were in the same general area. And then during that time, the 2nd and 3rd Brigades, or the first, the other two brigades of the 101st came over there. And, of course, they stayed in I Corps. So it was, we would move out of a base camp, and they would move in it. And it was one of those things going on. When we moved out of Tombstone / El Paso, one of the brigades went in there. So there was some shifting, and there was a lot more assets going up into I Corps, a lot, especially their mobile assets. And so in February, March is when we went into Sharon.
Okay.
And that's where I was actually at from that till I left Vietnam.
Okay. What was the operational tempo like in that area?
It was still pretty intense. Khe Sanh was busy.
Mm-hmm.
All the way going into the Eshowe Valley. Okay. It was very busy.
Okay.
Lots of missions, lots of free fire zones, lots of activity. A lot of scattered units after Tet were out there. They were cleaning up.
Mm-hmm.
That's why there was so many free fire zones up there.
Interesting. That brings up a quick question. During your briefings, when you first arrived in country, and then progressively as you became much more involved in operations themselves, in the operations in the S3 shop, what did you witness in terms of what were you briefed upon, and then what did you witness in terms of the rules of engagement? How did they affect the operations that your battalion engaged, your company and the battalion engaged in?
I don't think the rules changed at all.
What were the rules as you understood them?
Any uniform was a target. Any uniform with a weapon was a target. Any non-uniform person with a weapon was a target. There were some changes with support stuff. Animals like water buffalo, elephants, stuff like that. If you'd see them, shoot them. Bicycles, even, in certain areas would change. Especially when we went north after Tet, there would be large areas on the map where literally if anything moved in that area, you would shoot it. Period. So when maybe half the map in your whole area of operations was in a free fire zone, there was a lot of ammunition expended. I mean, literally, if anything moved, it was a target. So there were a lot of scattered units and scattered people. And there were a lot of civilians out there, I'm sure, too. But in the I Corps, right after Tet, lots and lots of free fire zones in the. And that was one of the things that I was doing, was as those free fire zones would move, I would move them on the maps, and then the pilots each morning would come in and then move their maps to the free fire zones, and then they would be constantly telling the crews as they're flying in and out, we're in it, we're out of it, you know. Those kind of things evolved, I would say.
Did you find that the rules of engagement prevented your unit from succeeding in any tactical or strategic ways?
Not our specific unit, no.
Okay. But in what ways? Other ways, perhaps?
Well, I think like what happened to the Marines up in Khe Sanh with couldn't go into Laos or Cambodia there, whatever the country was, across the river. I mean, you could see it. It was a big mountain on the other side, and they had guns dug back in the hill, but they couldn't go over and take those guns out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that tactic is just brain dead.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the cab didn't stay in Khe Sanh because the unit commander wouldn't allow that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
If we can't go there, then we're just going to get out there. I think it was no more complicated than that. So, again, tactically and rules of engagement that was set up in the White House was the brain dead part of the deal. But specifically about how our unit operated, I don't think it was radically affected.
Okay. what when you guys moved and began operating that in the Sharon, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
What were what changed in terms of the operations you conducted? What do you remember most about operating out of that particular in that particular area?
Well, Sharon ended up being one of our better base camps because we were there quite some time, and it got to develop, and, you know, floors for the tents and that kind of thing.
Okay.
Ammo crates and make your furniture. Mm. So we were there. Our operations bunker got bigger, stronger, deeper. Mm-hmm. The longer you were somewhere, your bunkers got bigger and better. Mm-hmm. And so that was my thought process there. As in, then as we started evolving into the Ashaw Valley planning, the rest of the 101st then, like I say, was starting to pick up some of our things that we had finished off, and I think that's then why they focused us over in the Ashaw.
What can you describe some specific operations you participated in?
Well, the next one obviously comes up is our operations going into the Ashaw Valley.
Mm-hmm. Was there a specific operational name attached to this portion of your work?
Yes.
Do you remember what it was?
I think it was Pegasus.
Okay.
I might be wrong on that.
Okay.
But yes, there was an operational name for it. But obviously, the Ashaw Valley was the end of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, mm-hmm. at that one of the main junctions coming into South Vietnam. And literally, except for some special forces functions, nothing has ever, there have never been any operations around in there.
Okay.
And what was, two main things were different. First of all, the CAV's modus operandi was never get outside your artillery coverage. Mm-hmm. Never go into a combat assault that you're not under our CAV's artillery. So if you had to go farther than that to make a combat assault, you first put up a forward fire support, combated, made a new fire support base that could cover where you're eventually going to go. Mm-hmm. Ashaw Valley, they didn't do this. The thought process was, it was 80 miles away. It was a long way away. And we would have tipped ourselves off if we would have started putting a fire base in near the Ashaw Valley. They would have clearly known what was going on. And the Ashaw Valley was 8-10,000 foot mountains on each side, mm-hmm. about a mile and a half nice valley floor. And we knew that there was a lot of anti-aircraft in the valley. We had heard what it could be. We'd been against a lot of 50 caliber before, small arms and 50 caliber. But we'd never really been against any true anti-aircraft. And they had the radar-controlled rapid-fire 37-millimeter and the conventional 85-millimeter flat guns in the valley. Mm-hmm. And obviously, the air mobile tactics that were developed really weren't ever developed to go into true anti-aircraft fire. I don't think, anyway. Mm-hmm. And so we were doing two things very different. For the issue of surprise, they weren't going to put in a forward fire support base, and we're going to go into a place with known heavy anti-aircraft. Mm-hmm. And it was going to be a big lift. Now, there seems to be some confusion now on the exact lift size going into the Ashaw. I read an operational report that said it was 40. I think a lot of us think it was more like 55 or 60 that went into the valley. Lift ships, mm-hmm. plus the accompanying guns and ARA. But it was a big lift, a lot of helicopters. And the first morning, the weather was so bad, the clouds were down to about 1,000 or 1,500 feet. And because the lift was so big, they couldn't put all the ships together. And we were basically loggered on the other out in some big openings the other side of the Eshaw Valley. And there was a lot of confusion. But probably personally, that particular morning, the first day going into the valley, wait a minute. That operation was Delaware. I have the after-action report in front of me.
Excellent.
On Delaware.
Okay.
At that time, Dave Nesset was our flight ops officer. And, again, we had a couple days to plan that mission going in there. And so that night, as usual, the night before, I made my last-minute changes. And I had scheduled myself to fly with Dave that day on Yellow 2. And Rocky was flying Yellow 1, by the way.
Oh, okay.
And I was flying with Dave in Yellow 2 slot. And we had an early morning crank, say 5:30 in the morning. And as I went down to the ship, Dave said, "You're not flying today." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "You're not flying today." I said, "Yes, I am." He said, "No, you're not." So we started an argument there. And again, as an NCO, really officer rank didn't mean much of anything to me. It was more of a respect issue. And we started literally yelling at each other, "Yes, I am. No, you're not. Yes, I am. No, you're not." And out of the black, Rocky's voice popped up and said, "Knock that shit off." So we knocked that shit off, and I went back up to the operations bunker. And the flight took off that day, and the Yellow 2 never came back. So obviously to this day, I mean, I know that I scheduled myself on that ship. I knew I was supposed to be on that ship. But they wouldn't let me go on that ship. And a lot of people had a lot of different ideas why he didn't. And why, typically what I would have done if Major Lane would have said something, I would have just told the gunner to go away and I would have been gone. But, of course, I've had all these feelings for 35 years. Why am I still here? Why didn't I go down that day? And last night, I pulled out this after-action report. And it just so happens, this was an operation report from, look at the front of it here. This is from Colonel Brown to Division Headquarters Commanding Officer. He talks about in here, 23, talking about the enemy, 23-millimeter automatic anti-aircraft guns, ZU-23s, 85-millimeter division, flat guns, D-44s, 85-millimeter anti-aircraft guns, assault SU-85 guns. Then it goes into this, actually talks about Yellow 2 going down in this report, which is unusual. It doesn't say Yellow 2. It's talking about the... I'll read this to you. It says, "As the aircraft approached the valley, there were approximately 6,500-foot main sea level. There were several reports of airburst from anti-aircraft positions on the valley floor, and the aircraft on the approach to the LZ were reporting receiving small arms fire and 50 cal fire. At this time, the gunships from the 229th and the 227th or not with the lifts of ships due to the delay in receiving the liftoff time from the PZ. So the slicks were going in bare. The 229th had the mission of landing the lower LZ, and the lead aircraft could not find a suitable place to set down. That was Rocky Lane. To the narrowness of the road and to the high degree of slope of the surrounding area, the hill. The enemy fire was very intense, and the lead aircraft made a go-round. The second aircraft, that was Yellow 2, Dave Nesset, commanding officer. The second aircraft received intense fire and was hit, but managed to land its troops in the LZ. Upon departure, now that was the first one in the LZ, Yellow 2 got its air troops on the ground. Upon departure, the aircraft again was hit, and when trying to return to the LZ, burst into flames and crashed. Throughout the initial assault, enemy fire was intense, and two aircraft were lost. Anyway, that's the aircraft I was supposed to be on that day. So I've always had this, you know, thought. You hear other guys with similar type things. You know, how come not me?
Yes, sir.
But that one specifically is pretty unnerving, and I'll obviously carry it to my grave.
Yes, sir.
But anyway, so going into the Eshaw Valley was over the next several days for our unit. We lost. I think we had five KIAs in our company, mm-hmm. about five more pretty badly wounded. Some of them came back, some of them didn't. Mm-hmm. We physically lost, I think we lost two ships in the valley, and then three more were DX'd. Just so bad, there was nothing left of them, but they got back or either got pulled, they were, went down, got lifted out of there. So the next day in the valley, we only had, I think we put six ships in the valley the first day. Lost four that day, didn't have. So that left the company 14. We put five or six in the next day. We lost one or two that day. Put us down to about 12 ships. Third day, we lost one ship. Fourth day, we lost one or two. We were down to, of our old complement of 20 ships, down to seven ships, I think, after about the fifth day. Now, by that time already, we'd been getting some brand-new hotel models shipped into us. And they were going back online. Hmm. But we lost a lot. We had a lot of damage. We had a lot of damage. But when you're in a helicopter and you see air burst out in front of you, I mean, that gets your attention.
Yes, sir.
That really gets your attention. On that day, mm-hmm. I brought something else in this morning. I hope I brought in.
Okay.
Yeah, I did. I wanted to read you something else.
Mm-hmm.
Later, I won't tell you who this email is from, but this is one of the guys you met at the I don't know the appropriate say his name.
Okay.
But this is one of the guys that you met over at the reunion.
Okay.
And when I first got in contact with him, he sent me a long email. And a lot of it is this particular day, and I'll just read you the portion about the Eshaw Valley. From the moment the assault on the Eshaw Valley began, the I'll put my finger down. From the moment the assault on the Eshaw Valley began, the radio was full of talk about aircraft taking hits and getting shot down. All that day, we went into the LZ after LZ knowing in our minds that it was probably our last sortie before we got killed. I had never been so afraid in all of my life, but we all kept going. By noon, I had taken hits in the rotor blades and seat supports. had developed a pretty good vibration and was sent back to get a new aircraft. I remember on the flight back praying to God that none would be available. By this time, you had gotten the news that Dave Nesset, had been killed. And I asked if there were any aircraft available, and you said that one was flyable, but had not been in enough deficiencies, but had all been red X'd, and that it couldn't be used on initial assault. It made it possible to refuse the aircraft. I did not want to go back, and so I told you that I wasn't going to take it. I was finished for the day. You laid into me like no one that I was married to had before or since about duty and my responsibility as an officer and as a leader in our unit. I took that aircraft because you made me realize that letting down the unit and my fellow crew members was a fate worse than death. You made me understand that the courage was not fearlessness, but instead the ability to function and complete the mission in spite of fear. I think about that incident every so often, most recently when you replied to my email. I want to thank you for that. If I succeeded in refusing to take the aircraft that day, I would have regretted it my entire life. In that respect, you saved my life. Thank you. I think that's that gives you really a flavor,
yes, sir,
of what was going on that day, mm-hmm, and how the operations ran. And I don't guess I really realized it until just last year or so, mm-hmm, until I started talking to some of the folks I was over there with, and just like the comments that Major Varner then made about me ordering where his tent went up, that rank really wasn't very important, or that it sure wasn't rank as we think about it in the traditional military sense, or about me dressing down a warrant officer about what he should do or how he's going to go out on a mission, or which ship he would or would not take. But I will have to think to myself that that period from Khantoum through the Aishal Valley was very formative to me in how I do things. And that those days were rather intense for about 7 or 8 months. And I'm still probably a pretty intense person in how I deal with folks and how I handle things or don't handle things about people giving me excuses. I don't accept excuses.
Okay.
And in Vietnam, we didn't accept excuses. We don't want to hear about ship can't fly. We don't hear about you can't do that. We've got to do whatever we've got to do to get the deal done. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the prevailing attitude. And if you went along with that attitude, you were fine. But if you didn't, you would be pushed aside, and somebody else would fill your place that did have that attitude. And that's why I've had a hard time accepting. Not now, Tommy. Not now. Hold on 1 second.
Turn the machine back on.
Sure.
Okay, go ahead.
So, again, that was an incredible informative. I'm saying informative, not informative, but had a lot of direction of how I conduct my life, I think.
Yes, sir.
And a lot of lessons I learned and didn't learn. And mm-hmm, I think it has to do a lot about my management style now, how I do things, where I'm a very hands-on type person in business. And I'm probably just as comfortable talking to bankers or out at the shop with doing some welding or whatever I've got to do.
Mm-hmm.
I'll do all those things on a hands-on. And that's, Vietnam was very hands-on. But anyway, the Aishal Valley, that day was bad. It was life-changing for me that particular day. The second day was a little bit better going into the valley. Each day was successively a little bit better. On the third day was the first day I flew into the valley. That night when we came back, you heard the little speech about Rocky made about, and we got to go do it again tomorrow morning, so buckle up. At that point, officially Walt was reinstated as operations officer. But at that point, Walt knew he didn't. It was a ceremonial position because I ran operations, and he knew that, and everybody else knew that. Mm-hmm. But there had to be an operations officer, of course. And I was wanting to fly the next day, and I started to get in the same argument with Walt about flying. And he said, we really don't need another demonstration of you yelling on the flight line tomorrow morning again, do we? I said, probably not. So Walt didn't fly the third day, and he said, you can fly today if you want to.
This is CD number 2 of the interview with Mr. Mike Ward. We're continuing the interview on the 9th of May, 2003 at 12 o'clock noon. Okay, go ahead, sir.
So the third day, I flew with John Pierce. The third day was more combat assaults. Mm-hmm. And I always like to fly with the better pilots. I thought, well, if I got to fly, I'm at least going to fly with the good ones. Mm-hmm. And I could. I could select who I'd fly with, what ship and what pilot. So I got the good ships with the good crew chiefs and the good pilots.
Okay.
And John was one of the best pilots. Very skilled. Mm-hmm. Very, very, very skilled. Nerves of steel. Good guy. And I made sure the Peter pilot that day was good. And the first lift going into the valley that, we were actually in the valley that morning down by the airfield, I think. And as we were going in, we were flying yellow 3, I think. And John made a point about it. He said, now, coming up here over on the right, the guns took out one of the radar control sites. You see it up just we turn around the bend up here. And just about that time, to my left, I saw what he was talking about. And typically, the radar control guns also had 250 calibers positions on each side of them to protect the radar control gun mm-hmm. from close in stuff. And about that time, I saw two or maybe three guys happened in seconds start climbing up on that 50 and start traversing the 50. It was between yellow 2 and yellow 3 at that time. I saw the tracer start to swing around on us. Well, about that time, all the gunners on the right side of the flight saw that 50 and started working out on it. And a half a second later, one of the guns came in on it and just obliterated it. And that's typically how it would work. Now, the 2 days before, the guns weren't there to help. And there were just too many of them that day. But John was at, not only was he skilled, but he also was always coaching and talking people through as we went through on the flight yesterday here. And that made me look where I hadn't been before. It was using his experience. So as that day went on, we continued to take several hits that day, a lot of small arm stuff. I don't think any 50, we didn't get hit by any 50 caliber, but there was a lot of 50 caliber flying around. I think most of the anti-aircraft guns, no. For sure they were taken out by the third day. There was no more of the 37 automatics or the flat guns. They had been all taken out. But lots of 50s and small arms left. And so we flew a handful of combat assaults that day. We're flying some log late in the afternoon. the ship was starting to hemorrhage some oil. We were losing, I think, not oil pressure, but we were pouring oil in the hydraulics almost faster than we could keep it going. We took several hits in one of the rotor blades late in the afternoon, so we went back to base camp to get another ship, and we'd received the mission that afternoon to fly into the log mission. Mm-hmm. And as we're landing the ship, it had a terrible, terrible vibration in it. Just a terrible vibration in it. And John was in big turmoil whether he should Red X the ship, take it back, what do you think? And later, I realized, and he said to me at the reunion, he said, I was afraid not to go on the ship because I didn't want to get the same thing that the person I just read that email to had told him about. So I didn't want somebody else ragging his ass, I guess. Mm-hmm. But anyway, for a lot of reasons, they flew a lot of times when they shouldn't have been flying, just to get the mission done. Mm-hmm. But it just so happened there was another ship that got released early. They went, took the log missions, and everything was fine. So the Shaw Valley was a huge success, divisionally wise, but it was a terrible thing for our particular company, and there was a lot of troops, a lot of folks lost their lives those days going on in the valley.
Mm-hmm. What would you estimate were your unit's total losses in the company?
Or in
the battalion?
I don't know. It was substantial. We actually lost either two or three ships down, not recovered. Then we lost another six or seven recovered, not flyable, later Red X'd. And then every ship had holes in it and was damaged. So over half.
Those are significant losses.
You're fucking right, that's significant. I mean, that was big time, got your ass kicked.
Yes, sir. And this is mostly NVA you were fighting up against?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was all NVA in the valley.
Yeah. Okay. This will end the interview with Mr. Mike Ward on the 9th of May. This is Steve Maxner continuing the interview with Mr. Michael Ward on the 2nd of July, 2003, at approximately 1:35 Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Ward is in, not Dallas, Fort Worth, correct?
Dallas, Texas.
Oh, you are in Dallas. Okay,
yeah.
Dallas, Texas. Sir, why don't we pick up today's interview with a brief discussion of some of your perspectives as you were preparing to leave country, leave Vietnam, and in particular, when you were getting ready to leave, what did you think about your service in Southeast Asia? What did you think about the overall American efforts in Southeast Asia?
I guess when I was leaving, it got to a point where I was probably just overwhelmed with a year there and overwhelmed with the intensity of basically working 7 days a week and, I don't know, probably averaging 14 on a short day and 20 on a long day, and you just kind of get ground down physically and then mentally also. But as time, as our favorite term over there, short, as you became short, there wasn't probably a lot of global perspective on was this a good thing or was this a bad thing. We were all certainly aware that there was a lot of anti-war protests going on back in the States. But probably as I'm winding down, that's surely not heavy on my mind. I was comfortable with what I was doing, but I wanted to get back real bad. I had one of the offers if I would have stayed like, I think, 3 more weeks. I would have got out like 6 months earlier, 4 months earlier, something like that, and I wouldn't stay 3 weeks to get out 6 months early.
Mm-hmm.
Or four, whatever that number was. Mm-hmm. I think if you had less than 6 months or less than 6 months mm-hmm. Left on your tour, they would have discharged you from Vietnam. But I just, 3 more weeks was just an untenable mental situation at that point in time. I just absolutely had enough. And probably also my unit had gotten in my replacement about 3 weeks before I left. Mm-hmm. So my last 3 weeks in country were pretty much stand down for me. I did very little flying. I didn't have a lot to do in the operations side since there was a replacement there for me, and we got him trained. But I just couldn't quite fathom another 3 weeks over there, and I wanted to get home real bad. Mm-hmm. So I passed on that and clipped my coupon and decided to come home.
Okay. Now, did you think that the war was going well for the United States and our allies in South Vietnamese?
Well, as far as I could tell, mm-hmm. I mean, each military action we were in, we overwhelmingly trounced them. Mm-hmm. There was never a even when our grunts were in heavy contact, at the end of the contact, the end of the day, there were still that proverbial body counts of 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 to 1. Mm-hmm. So when you looked at just on a scorecard basis, I never saw an action over there, and I don't think there were many actions over there where we didn't just have overwhelming end result superiority in a given battle or campaign. And I wasn't aware of any time. We took heavy losses several times, but when you looked in perspective, we dealt out extremely heavy losses to them on a very day in, day out, week in, week out, month in, month out basis. Mm-hmm. So it appeared to me on a military basis we were kicking their butts, and that was my view at that point.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, how much had you been hearing about the war as it was being presented to the American people from letters or hometown newspapers or American magazines, not necessarily the Stars and Stripes, because, of course, that was produced by the military, but and so might have left out some of the perspectives back on the home front. When you got back to the United States, were you surprised at all by what you saw, or did that help prepare you seeing some news?
Well, I probably saw more before I left than when I was over there. I probably didn't see a half a dozen copies of the Stars and Stripes, and those were usually weeks and weeks old.
Okay.
And when I went on my R&R to Hawaii, I saw things, but I think it's interesting that. In that particular year, which would have been halfway through I went to Hawaii just before the Tet Offensive, mm-hmm. and met my wife and saw my son for the first time. He was born when I was over there. I was just over there, I think I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. 6 weeks or 2 months when he was born, so I saw him. She brought him to Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And my perspective is that the Hawaiian people were completely different than the mainland people, probably because of Pearl Harbor, and they were much more, and because of the heavy military presence in Honolulu, and mm-hmm. it wasn't a hotbed of anti-war. And to the contrary, I remember one of the times my wife and son, we went out and ate in what was for that time an expensive restaurant. It was a $35 or $40 bill for a very nice seafood dinner. Mm-hmm. When I asked for the bill, the waiter said, "It's been taken care of." And I said, "What do you mean it's been taken care of?" And he said, "That gentleman over there took care of it for you." And I looked over there, and he was, I don't know, 55 or 60 years old, and he had a wife of a similar age sitting at a table, and I got up and came over and said, "Do I know you?" And he said, "No, but I know what you're doing over there, and we really appreciate it."
Wow.
And so I think that was a general feeling in the Hawaiian Islands, for probably because of the military presence there, but they were much warmer to it. So during my time over there, and when I came back for my R&R, I didn't see a strong anti-war presence, and never was there a word in any of my correspondence to home about something like that. So I was probably very insulated as far as that goes.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did you feel when you left Vietnam? as far as...
Well, they just about didn't let me go because I think I weighed 133 pounds.
Oh, my.
When I went over there, I think I weighed 185 or something like that, and I'm 6'1".
Mm-hmm.
And so at 131 pounds, that's a 50-pound or so loss, and I was pretty emaciated.
Mm-hmm.
Not because I was misfed, mistreated, or anything else, just the lack of calories and the tremendous temperature and a lot of sweating going on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They're just very, very thin. And when you're leaving and they give you a venereal disease check and a general physical,
right,
as they're shuffling through lines very fast, somebody looked at my weight and looked at my chart, and there was a little conference about the, with a couple of doctors or nurses or whoever were doing this exit physical about my weight and asked, you know, how you feeling? I said, I'm fine. I'm getting out of here. Well, I said, don't even think about it. I'm hitting the next plane. I'm gone. And but I was. I was just at 131 pounds. I was just really very, very thin.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just glad to get on the plane and start heading back.
Absolutely. Well, what would they have done?
Well, they were talking about, I think the chit-chat that I didn't completely get, do we need to ground him for a few days in the hospital and get some calories in and get him some pounds back on him? Because
mm-hmm.
You're
a tall guy. You're over 6 feet, aren't you?
I'm 6'1", right.
Yeah.
And I weigh 2'5 or 2'10 now, and at that time I probably weighed 185, something like that. So when I was 133 or 31 pounds, I was thin.
Yes.
But when I got back, anything I would touch or eat or feel, the pounds came right back on me because that's just my normal weight is way up there. So
yeah.
I was just lacking calories. It's just
really
not much more complicated than that.
Right.
A lot of energy, you know, it's mass balance, energy in and energy out. And
yes,
it's all going out, not much going in over there.
Right.
So I remember the... You know, I got all the classic things about how the theory at that time was to get you out of there as quick as you possibly can and get you home as quick as you possibly can. And, of course, they've learned from that that's not the right way to go.
Mm-hmm.
I think I left Vietnam on July 3rd, which was, I think, July 2nd here or the 4th in there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I came back into... the Seattle Processing Center, Seattle, Tacoma. And the plane gets in there at like, you know, 1 o'clock at night or 2 o'clock in the middle of the night or something like that. And you get a real quick records check, and they put you through a line where they put people were on that plane dressed in anywhere from literally civilian suits, but most guys had jungle fatigues on and jungle boots. A few dress uniforms from the guys coming out of Saigon and that kind of stuff. And most of the guys didn't have anything left. You lost basically all your goods when you were over there.
Wow.
And for lost, destroyed, disappeared, who knows, I don't remember where they all went to. But so you literally had what was on your back, and that was all. And so they, I remember the, It struck me at 2:30 or 3 in the morning where they're fitting you up for a new uniform.
Mm-hmm.
And for the first time, this is actually a tailored uniform. This isn't throw it on, it fits, you'll grow into it or you'll grow out of it. They were actually tailoring uniforms in the middle of the night and seeing these ladies sitting at sewing tables. And there were, you know, 35, 45, 50-year-old women just happy and just real. Everybody was very jovial and they were sewing your patches on and getting you all ready to go and putting you in a fresh dress uniform and then putting you then you went to a chow hall where they had two things, either lobster or steak.
Mm-hmm.
And all the other rich foods, you know, the ice creams and milks and stuff that you never saw over there.
Mm-hmm.
And by about 4:30 or 5 in the morning, within inside 2 or 3 hours, they'd put you in a brand new beautifully tailored uniform on, the only one I ever had, And I need one, 131 pounds or whatever I weighed then. Mm-hmm. And by 4:30 or 5, we were on a bus to take us to the Seattle Tacoma Airport, which was the private way to get out. And when I'm at the Seattle Tacoma Airport, standing in line to get my ticket, I'm looking across the way, and I see Major Varner there, my number one CO over there mm-hmm. that we talked about a little bit earlier. Mm-hmm. And he was on the opposite line getting the ticket to go home. And I knew that he was behind me by 6 or 7 weeks. And so I got out of line. I had plenty of time. And I walked over there, and we shook hands and talked. And I asked him, what are you doing here, and how'd you get out early? And he said, well, I've got me a good assignment. I'm going to West Point to be an instructor there. So he was headed to West Point to be an instructor. And we shook hands and said goodbye, and then the next time we saw him was April 19th of 2003 in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Wow. This reunion.
Yeah, at that reunion. So, and lost all contact with him. So, get back in line, get my seat, and at that time, my wife was living in Kansas City mm-hmm. under the somewhat wing of my mother, who lived in Sedalia, Missouri, outside of Kansas City, and a brother living in Kansas City. So I got a ticket from Seattle to Kansas City. And my posting out of Vietnam was Fort Benning, Georgia. That's all I knew at that point in time. And I got on the plane at Seattle time. It's 8 or 9 or 10 o'clock. It was an early morning flight. And I get in Kansas City late in the afternoon at the old downtown Kansas City airport. Mm-hmm. And my wife was waiting there. And we had a real nice hug, and we were walking down the aisleway, though, and this is a shutdown airport now. And for some reason, she didn't want any other family members to be there. She wanted me to be the one to welcome me home. And my brother snuck away from work, and he came out and saw me. Mm-hmm. And so we got in our car and drove home and had a real nice leave, had the proverbial 30 days off. Mm-hmm. The next day, I think, was July 4th or 5th. I think I got home on July 4th or right around there sometime. And at the airport, my brother said, well, you got to come down to the lake, Lake of the Ozarks in Missouri. Mm-hmm. I got me a new boat. He had like a 32 or 33-foot Chris-Craft cabin cruiser. Oh, boy, that sounds great. Mm-hmm. And so spent that night at my mother's house, and next morning we go down to Lake of the Ozarks. And the fireworks went off, and I hit the deck of the boat, and everybody's looking at me like, what is your problem? Yeah. So had a few days later, maybe a week later, for some reason, I was on Interstate 70 going between Kansas City and St. Louis, or actually between St. Louis and Kansas City, about halfway around the center of the state, around Columbia, Missouri. Mm-hmm. As I'm driving down the highway, it was a divided four-lane even back that far. Mm-hmm. I glanced to my left. Somebody was passing me. And I looked real close, and I said, boy, that looks familiar. And I turned my head and looked real clearly, mm-hmm. and it was Rocky Lane and his family. My second CO.
Yeah, your second CO. Yeah.
Rocky. Mm-hmm. And so I sped up, and we waved, and he pulled over, and we hugged, and we met each other's family, and what are you doing, and yada, yada, yada. And Rocky was on his way to the West Coast to catch a plane, and he was posted to Hawaii. Okay. So we were about a 45-minute or hour drive from Sedalia to my mother's house, and so we agreed to postpone his trip and come to Sedalia. And we spent that afternoon at my mom's house and introduced him to all my family and his family. We had a real nice chat there. And I think he stayed all that night and left the next morning. Okay. And I lost track of Rocky and didn't see him until the Charlottesville reunion April 19th, 2003.
Wow.
Excuse me. No. I saw Rocky 2 years earlier at a Vietnam Crew Members Association meeting in Louisville.
Okay.
That's right. I'd seen Rocky. So that was my 30-day leave. It was, a good leave, and I go down to Fort Benning, Georgia, and check in. And by that time, my 131-pound frame was probably 150. I probably put 20 pounds on that month, and the uniform didn't fit.
Okay.
Didn't have anything to check in with, and that was an interesting deal.
Mm-hmm.
And as I'm checking in, I knew that Bill Paris was down there. And you remember Infantry Lieutenant Bill Paris?
Oh, yes.
From
yes.
the reunion?
I started interviewing him as well.
Well, I knew Bill Paris was down there. And, of course, mm-hmm. Bill Paris was kind of our adopted infantry lieutenant of our aviation company.
Okay.
And I knew he was at Fort Benning, and so he said, and as we're leaving, we were similar dates, he said, you be sure and call me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I called him as soon as I got to Fort Benning, and he said, don't check in. I said, what do you mean? He said, I'm at the Officers Infantry Candidate School, and he said, I think I can get you in here, and it'd be a great posting for you. I said, well, I'm supposed to check in tomorrow morning. He said, no, don't do it. He said, I know it's going to take me 2 or 3 days, so don't check in for at least 3 days. I said, I'll be late by 3 days. He said, don't worry about it. I can handle it. I said, okay. So I took that time, and I don't know what I did, but anyway, we fooled around for 3 days more, and I checked in, and, of course, I was 3 days late, and he said, where you been, all that, and yada, yada, yada. And but there was a note, and they said, oh, I see you're posted at the Infantry Officers Candidate School. And I said, I am. Oh, yeah. Oh, okay, what's that? So Bill had evidently spoken to the commanding officer of the school and told him about me and said that it would be great if we could get me involved in order. So anyway, when I checked in, they already had a slot for me, and I think that afternoon I went over there, and I spent my last 6 months in the service or 5 months in the service at Fort Benning, Georgia, with one of the most cush jobs in the military at the Officers Candidate School down there.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of our other Vietnam friends were over at Savannah Army Air Base, Walt Levering, several other guys were at that reunion there.
Mm-hmm.
And we would drive back and forth across weekends, and we got to meet each other's wives and continued to more of a stateside camaraderie when we got to meet each other's families. And that's how I spent my last 6 months in the military at Fort Benning.
Okay. Now, did you have any aspirations whatsoever staying in?
No.
All right. Maybe it was a ludicrous question, but I had to ask it.
Yes, yes. Actually, we had several. There were several times, in the military where they try to sit you down and talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time they got to know me, they would not even. Or they would say, well, we're not going to even have that talk because we don't want to waste our breath with you because we know that there's nothing that's going to keep you in here.
Okay.
Right. But it does remind me that one of the things that the Infantry Officers Candidate School was really big on, and that was having awards and decoration ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
And as best I remember, there were 26 classes going all the time. Every 2 weeks, there was a new class coming in.
Okay.
And they would get all 26 classes, companies,
mm-hmm.
Out on the grinder pad and have these gargantuan awards and decoration ceremonies probably at least once a month, maybe more often than that.
Okay.
And, of course, everybody in the school was a returned Vietnam veteran. That's
mm-hmm.
all they wanted there. If you weren't a veteran of Vietnam, you weren't qualified to go into the school.
Okay.
And or there might have been an exception or two in the
2 or 3% for some special reasons, but basically it was all recently returned Vietnam vets as the cadre there. And I don't know whether it's always done this way or not, but it just happened that at this particular awards and decoration ceremony, there was probably 6 or 7 guys up on the stage. And as a buck sergeant, I was at the end of the table, mm-hmm. or end of the stage. And don't remember the name of the 3-star general, but it's either the 1st or 5th Army, which is the Eastern United States, whatever army that is in the Eastern United States, was at Fort Benning for the Awards and Decoration Ceremony. Mm-hmm. And he was pinning the medals on, and he was shaking everybody's hand. And then there was a colonel at a podium reading off the citations. And I think there was a captain or a major handling the little boom mic. And so they got down to me, and they did the deal and pinned this thing on me, and the general starts to walk the stage to give his little speech, and the colonel says, excuse me, Sergeant Ward has another decoration, sir. So he comes back, and they read off the second one, yada, 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 yada. Pins on me, shakes my hand, starts going back to stage. He says, excuse me, General so-and-so, Sergeant Moore's got another decoration here. So after the 4th time of this going down there, and all the senior officers getting some minor little things, he shakes my hand. He says, I don't guess there's possibly anything else you could ask for today, is there? And I looked at him. I said, yes, sir, a discharge. And this was on the PA system, and this broke out several hundred people from the formations laughing and pounding themselves on the ground. And this was not a good thing to do to a 3-star general. And among 26, in front of 26 companies of infantry officer candidates. And so wasn't but probably an hour or 2 hours later, and I was in front of the, I believe he was either a full colonel or 1-star general, who was the company commander of the infantry officer candidate school. Mm-hmm. And he was telling me about how inappropriate this was and all the terrible things they were going to do to me and all this kind of stuff. And he says, I guess we can not go through the drill of talking to you about extending, can't we? And I said, I think that's probably a pretty good idea, sir. And at that time, I think he said, get out of my sight or something like that, and I left. But that when you brought up the thing that they were talking about extending, mm-hmm. well, that's why he didn't talk about extending with me, I think.
Okay. Well, when you did get out of the military, what were your plans? Did you have any solid plans yet?
Yeah. I was going to go back into business for myself. Was in business for myself before I went into the military, and it probably took me all of, 2 weeks to be back scratching myself again.
Okay.
And that's basically what I've done all my life, being in business for myself. So that was my modus operandi.
Mm-hmm. What, did you have anything in particular in mind as far as a business, or you just knew no matter what, it was going to be self-employment?
Well, I don't even remember what the thought process was at that time, but I knew that I could always do better for myself than I could working for somebody else, especially Uncle Sam.
Mm-hmm.
And although I cleanly and clearly understood what we were doing in Vietnam and why we were there, I didn't understand stateside military at all, because it was just exactly the opposite, obviously, mm-hmm. especially going from an assault helicopter company to the infantry officers candidate school. I mean, it's more than night and day. Yeah. It's outer space, inner space. I mean, those are just you just couldn't get anything farther apart from each other.
Hmm. Well, in what ways did your Vietnam War experience affect your outlook on life and your the activities that you engaged in shortly after getting out of the military?
Well, it probably affected me more than I ever know. Everybody that knows me well tells me how much I changed in Vietnam. I said, how? And they, well, we can, you're more serious now. And, words like that. And I perceptively can't tell how it changed me, but I know that it profoundly changed me, and I know that the relationships that I had with people profoundly changed me. Specifically, instances of how you lead and motivate people, how you make judgments on people, how you get things done the quickest, most easily, with the least amount of grief. You know, where's loyalty and trust with people? There's a lot of military terminology and things when you talk about, or it's common in military when you talk about loyalty and leadership and those qualities and how that affects business and how I like to surround myself with people that I feel are extremely loyal or extremely trustworthy. And to a lot of degrees like that of how I see things. I mean, I've gotten criticized many times how I view raising children, discipline, things like that. That probably has affected me and how I do a lot of things in life.
Now, you already mentioned that some people have said that you seem more serious. How has that affected, or how has the war affected your personal relationships with people? And as you just brought up, you know, your thoughts about child rearing and discipline and things of that nature.
Well, I guess one of the things that is clear to me as far as military discipline goes. When the rubber meets the road, you don't have time to explain. And that's discipline. When a crisis hits, you don't have time to go through the niceties of why you're doing it. Yada, 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 yada. You need instant action. And I can think of times in my life when my kids have thought I was way too strict on them or expected way too much out of them and how they reacted on certain things. And I can also think as they've grown older when they've come to have perspective and say, I'm really glad, Dad, that you did so-and-so because it kept me from this happening to me later on in life. So, and I think that you know, getting serious in Vietnam, I went to a 10-year class reunion and nobody knew me. They said, boy, you're a bore ass. You were the class clown. They didn't use the word class clown, but I was yak-yakking all the time. And the same thing with my college friends. They said, boy, what's that? You're a different person. And I probably am a different person. But it was a year-long perspective change of very hard, dedicated work, pulling together as a team. It's a life-changing experience when you do those kind of things over there and rely on other people, and they rely upon you as much or more, and there's no room for error. There's no room for mistakes. There's no room for second chance. There's no room for yada yada. You do it right the first time, every time, with no excuses. And that's how you live and come back from there. And if you don't, you know, that was an excuse. And that's how I do business. It's done right the first time, no excuses, no yada yada. And if you can't do that, go somewhere else. So it sure has changed my focus and perspective on things.
When you, as you went forth and were working for yourself and going into business, did you find it difficult to talk about your Vietnam experiences, or did you shy away from it as a topic of discussion with people?
I don't think it was either or.
Okay.
My family, the people, my friends, the ones who were around me, it was a non-issue. All of the anti-war hoopty-raw, mm-hmm. although I saw it on television, since I didn't associate with anybody like that, it wasn't very close to me. Mm-hmm. It was in the TV and on that. But I made sure that I didn't go around people like that because I didn't want to get in a confrontation. Right. And probably to this day, I'm the same way. I'll just stay away from people. Mm-hmm. We'll call it ultra-left-wing people. Mm-hmm. That's what term I use today.
Okay.
And I just stay away from them because of their what I would consider a very liberal view on things and how the liberals tend to be on those kind of sides of things. So I just don't associate with those folks and stayed away from them, and so it really never affected me too much.
Okay.
I would say it's probably affected other people more than it has me, because if I ever learned that, I've probably done things in my life where let's just skip that.
Okay. Well, when you wait, you said it was a non-issue with family and friends.
Mm-hmm.
Was it just a topic that wasn't brought up? Did you find that people were kind of apathetic or non-interested in it, especially as the war continued after 1968 and the 69? Nixon came in.
Right.
Or eventually the Vietnamization and the downsizing, and basically we're getting out of this thing.
Yeah. I never bought Vietnamization. I knew that wouldn't work, or I believed it would not work. I didn't know, but I couldn't see how it worked.
Right.
I mean, I saw the, you know, we took Vietnamese units on combat assaults 25, 35, 45 times when I was over there.
Mm-hmm.
Something, I don't know, a lot. And the most impressive thing was how many pigs and chickens and things that they could carry in the combat assault with them,
mm-hmm.
which told me, I mean, their mind was in the whole raw, incorrect mindset of how to do that, where our guys saw how much ammunition or water they could carry in. They thought how much fresh food they're going to get to barbecue that night.
Mm-hmm.
So I could never believe that they would be successful in fighting the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong, mm-hmm. which were very serious warriors, and it just wouldn't work. So as that went on, I started accepting my mind this could have a very ugly ending now.
Mm-hmm.
Very ugly.
Mm-hmm.
Did I answer your question?
Yes, sir. I think you did. But did you ever find that, not necessarily immediately after you came back from Vietnam, but all the way through, say, to before the Gulf War, through the 1970s and through the 80s, Did you find that people would react differently to you if the subject of Vietnam came up and the fact that you were a Vietnam veteran was brought up in conversation? Did you find that people would react or respond to that in a different way or in different ways?
If I was scoring it, I would say it was much more positive than negative, even early on.
Okay.
Now it seems to be kind of a light, trendy thing to be a Vietnam veteran.
Yeah.
It's not such a bad deal quite now.
Right.
Since the Gulf War, obviously, that changed, that flipped everything. That just absolutely flipped everything.
Mm-hmm.
And but before that, I would say I always got much more positive than that. I'll say it again. I don't tend to associate with left-wing type people or ultra-liberals.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the people that tend to have those type views. And, you know, when I would hear about somebody that went to Canada, I could assure you I was not around them at a cocktail party.
Mm-hmm.
Just wouldn't happen. So I've just, I won't put myself in a position knowingly for a conflict with somebody like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I've handled it.
What did you think, going back to 1975, what did you think about how the war ended?
I don't even want to use the word devastated, but, boy, it was terrible. I was terrible. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I to this day I can't, I don't want to let think that everything was in vain, and I don't think it was. Mm-hmm. Have I talked to you about some of my Chinese business associates and their thoughts on the Vietnam War and what they were doing?
I don't. No, you have not.
Well, I've always taken the general view, mm-hmm. and in the last 5 or 8 years have taken a harder view on that. Even what we did wasn't obviously a clear-cut victory in any stretch of the imagination. The end result was exactly the same, mm-hmm. or almost. One of the major thought processes about Vietnam was the domino theory. Right. And, you know, that's been just the domino theory, the domino theory. And I believe that there could be a very, very well-documented case today that the domino theory was 100% correct. And, in fact, we kept the domino theory from happening. As you're aware of, I think, Steve, my core business is involved with importing automotive things out of mainland China.
Yes, sir.
And I've spent a few man years in mainland China over the last 20 years. I started going there in 1984 when the Red Guard was still on the streets a little bit. And I've seen a profound change in the Chinese society, government, industry, people. And that's 20 years or so, almost. Mm-hmm. And have made many close ties over there, many close ties, and know lots of people over there. Mm-hmm. And the people my age now were Vietnam age back then. So the Chinese are absolutely fascinated that I was in Vietnam, mm-hmm. and fascinated with what I did and love to talk about it. And most of the people that I deal with now are senior something people. Either they're the senior people in a factory or in the government or somewhere now, because they're 45 to 60 year old folks, and these are the people running China now.
Okay.
And because I've been over there so long, there's so many of them that know what I was involved in Vietnam, mm-hmm. that when they'll introduce me to somebody else on another trip, they'll say, "Oh, Mr. Mike was in Vietnam. He was with a helicopter unit over there." Yada yada yada. So it's a common, very, very common thing to talk about at dinner time with them.
Mm-hmm.
And in the last few years, I've been saying, "Tell me, what did you do during the Vietnam time?" And to a man, I've never talked to one that wasn't involved some way in the Vietnam War.
Wow.
If they were in a military unit, if they were in a factory job, if they were in a government job, they were somehow doing something for Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Their whole existence in life at that point in time when we were over there,
mm-hmm.
was basically it's more than common to run into people that their job was to drive a supply truck to the railhead for ammunition going into Vietnam.
Wow.
Their job was working at a outboard motor. I remember two people I met that worked in the only outboard motor factory in China, that makes a gas. They make several diesel, but throwing gasoline, and that literally 100% of their little outboard motors, which I take are like 50 or 80 cc motors,
mm-hmm.
were all being shipped to Vietnam for running up and down the canals and the rivers, and their factories were running 24/7 to try to keep up with the need. And it goes on and on and on and on and on. They were all somehow involved with supplying and helping the brethren North Vietnamese, mm-hmm. and that it didn't cripple the country, but it stopped them from looking elsewhere. Mm-hmm. They didn't have, and later it proved out that the Chinese and Vietnamese were not real good friends, that they didn't have time, the Chinese really didn't have time to support Pol Pot or get involved in that too much. They had to back away from Thailand. Mm-hmm. They were consumed with supporting North Vietnam. They didn't have time to do any other mischief that they would have liked to have done. Mm-hmm. And at that time, they were in an incredibly political phase of China, mm-hmm. where their industry was just getting going. They were just starting to be mischievous. But much like the Russians, we spit them under the ground.
Yes.
And so I think that there was a domino effect that our involvement, although we didn't have a end strategic victory in Vietnam, which I mean Vietnam as a strategic situation went communist after we left, that surely wasn't a victory, but the big picture of communism being contained stopped over there. And if we weren't over there and we wouldn't have done that, they would have been a very different thing. And I would love to have the time in the rest of my – I would love to have the time left on this earth to sit down and document that, because I know it's a fact now. Can't prove it yet. Don't have – you know, it isn't documented. But from all my dozens to maybe hundreds of evening conversations with Chinese and what they were doing during the war leads me to believe that it's not a – it's not anything except fact that that's exactly what the whole country was involved with, was supporting the North Vietnam. And they didn't have time or energy to do anything else or the ability to get into any other mischief. And so now you can mark that down this date. This is the Mike Ward theory, the anti-domino theory.
Okay. Well, you know, it's actually there are a number of other people that share your view that I've talked
about. Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. That in terms of the, not necessarily with this, based on the specific experiences you've had with talking with Chinese, but
if you run across people like that, I would love to chat with them.
I think it was one of the former presidents of Singapore that made a comment very similar to on the opposite side, that it was because of the American involvement in Southeast Asia that the other countries around Vietnam and around Southeast Asia were able to solidify their free market mm-hmm. capitalism and democratic mm-hmm. systems. And if that hadn't happened, then yes, the domino theory very well could have.
Right.
Yeah. So it's right. Kind of the flip side of the coin that you just outlined. So what about Americans? You seem to obviously have some very interesting conversations with these Chinese businessmen and people that you met in your business. Did you ever have interesting and engaging conversations like that with Americans that may have either served or participated in certain events surrounding the Vietnam War?
Probably not, because I've iterated earlier mm-hmm. that I tend to stay away from left-wing mm-hmm. folks that I could be in a negative conversation about.
Yeah.
So, no, I haven't. No, I haven't.
Just curious.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand.
Yeah. Let's see. Did you, in the early part of your time back, let's say from 1968, when you got back in July mm-hmm. of 68, through to the end of the war, did you ever personally witness any really negative anti-war activity or anti-veteran activity, anything that, you know, was offensive?
If I did, I blanked it out.
Okay.
I mean, I when I sit back in Vietnam, I got to really think about the bad stuff. I only remember the good stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably the same thing I would have. I stay away from those kind of things. I don't associate with people like that, right. So I don't. And if I did, it wasn't catastrophic to me. And it didn't,
yeah.
You know, if I saw them, what a bunch of dumb shits, and just, you know, lightly played it off. I've had a few conversations at, let's call this a senior business level type folks where I couldn't pick my company very well. Mm-hmm. And some academia started in on things about Vietnam, and a couple times there were people that, you know, went to Canada, and I usually have a pretty pat answer to those people. I said, well, you have no choice but to continue the same view, or you would have to admit what a fool you were when you went to Canada. Now, mm-hmm. wouldn't you? Mm-hmm. And that just, every time, it just shut them down right in their tracks. Because the people that did go to Canada, if they still weren't on their soapbox, they would have to admit that they did a bad thing when they went there. And they're not about to do that.
That's a good point.
But that's happened occasionally, but that's more fun than not.
Let's see. Do you think that, before I talk about some broad questions about the American people in the Vietnam War, in the 1980s, when the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund raised enough money and erected the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, the wall in D.C., have you visited that? And what do you think of that? If you have, what do you think of that monument?
Yes, I have many times.
Mm-hmm.
It's very stirring. It hurts. When you say it, I mean, you know, I don't know if I can articulate very well my thoughts except to say that I donated heavily to the wall. I was glad when it was done. I was glad with the concept. I think the design design of it, the execution was great. The theory of how they've done it, how they run it, how they lay out, I've got no complaints except everything positive to say. And every time that I go to Washington, I should say every time, 9 out of 10 times when I go to Washington, and I do go there usually several times a year, I've got to stop by and go by and say hi. The last time or time before I was there, must have been the spring because there's a lot of tourists there. And as I'm walking out of the wall, there was a gentleman, maybe 35. He had two boys, one maybe 7 or 8, one maybe 9 or 10. And as they're walking down the path, one of the little boys looked up at his dad and said, Daddy, what was Vietnam about? And his dad looked down to him and said, Son, I don't know if I can explain that to you or not. And I don't think probably most people at 35 can explain anything about it or touch on it. And when I go there, it's interesting to hear people's opinions of things. And you can't, and maybe my ears tune up and listen to people around me as they talk. But it's interesting. I'm going to be there this month, and I'm going to be visiting the wall this month. And one of my coworkers here, we're introducing a new vehicle to law enforcement show in Washington, D.C., the 23rd and 24th of this month. And we're staying an extra day, and this one of these gentlemen worked with me here. He said, Mike, I want you to take me by and show me the wall. I said, sure. So I'll go. I don't know whether if I can, healing's not the right word, but it's great glue. It's great glue that keeps the thoughts and memories all together. But everything's positive there. It's not negative.
Now, do you think that we as a nation have learned all we can from our Vietnam War experiences?
I think we've learned all we can in this generation, and I just hope it doesn't get lost down the road. I think when we look at all the, and I could say all the upper and senior officers in Desert Storm were all Vietnam lieutenants and captains, and they learned. And but are we going to forget? Let's hope not. But we surely learned from that group of people, starting at Colin Powell. And so, yeah, we took the. I think we learned our lessons well over there with that, and we transmitted them at least into the senior leadership as of this time right now we're in. Whether 100 years from now, I don't know. Let's hope so.
Well, what do you think about some of the more recent American deployments, in particular, the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, this most recent war in Iraq, and other American deployments around the world, whether they be some of the more, controversial, I guess it would be a good way to put it, controversial policies like what we did in Somalia or versus Bosnia, peacekeeping operations, that kind of stuff.
Well, I think it's proven any time we don't go in strong with our gun cocked, we're okay. And if we don't do that, we're going to get in trouble, like Somalia. When they, and I think it's pretty well known knowledge that President Clinton didn't want armor to go in there for, among other reasons. It looked too provocative. Well, a bunch of APCs and tanks running down to pull those pilots out, they might be here today. So if we've learned the lesson, if we're going to go do it, let's go do it to win quickly the first time. But have we done that every time? No. But as our system is a system of political leadership. Some leaders learn better than others.
Yes.
And by the time he's in the White House, there's not much we can do about it then. So,
is there anything specific or anything in particular that you would want to identify as probably the most important thing we should keep in mind or we should learn from our Vietnam War experiences?
Don't go unless you're prepared to go in to win with overwhelming force and do it, or don't go.
Did the war, what would you say were the most important ways the war affected you personally? Whether they be personal in terms of your outlook on life or spiritual or religious, whatever.
That would take a lot of deep reflection. I don't think we have time for that today.
Good enough. Maybe it's a question we can revisit some other time.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about today?
No. Not that I can think of right now.
All right, excellent. Let me go ahead and put an official ending on our interview then. Thank you very much, Mr. Ward. This will end the interview with Mr. Michael Ward.